matrices, but then also gives us meaningful data. So again, I don't want to get into too much of what we're going to be doing, but I figure I just plant the seed. That's what we're going to be doing, and then I'm sure we'll repeat it over and over over the course of the next couple of days. This workshop is just the first step in a process, so we're hoping that by the end of tomorrow we're going to have some draft best practices and draft metrics, and then the real work is going to begin after that. So there was a lot of prep that went into this workshop. I'll be seeing a lot of thank yous over the next couple of days. But for now, I wanted to just run through the agenda and briefly recognize the people that are talking today. These are our researchers, our evaluators, our content experts. They've all traveled here. They've given us a lot of guidance as to what this agenda should look like, what this workshop should look like. But just wanted to really call out and say thank you to these people for enduring a lot of phone calls with us over the past couple months. Forrest Simmons, thank you so much. Mark Stern, Michelle Zint, Trudy Volk, Bill McBeth, Rachel Becker-Klein, Bo Hoppin, Julian Gautremont-Smith. I will be telling you a lot more about these people when I introduce them later today. But I just want to let you all know, thank you so much for coming here today. And then to let everybody else know that these people, not only are presenting, not only are they did they give us some guidance about what this workshop should look like, but they're also going to be rolling up their sleeves with us over the next couple days. So I think it's just a fantastic opportunity to get their knowledge and then collective knowledge in this room. So if you could, let's just go ahead and look at the agenda for just today. We'll tackle tomorrow when we get there. So we're going to have an introduction by Nick DePasquale from Chesapeake Bay Program, who I'll introduce shortly. And then following that, we're going to have Jamie and Shannon sort of really lay the groundwork for what we're going to be doing over the next couple days. So no pressure, Jamie or Shannon. Just explain all of this perfectly clearly in 40 minutes or less. And then we're going to begin with our presenter. So we're going to have Bora talking about NAAA guidelines for excellence, and that's going to be followed by Mark Stern, who's sharing some hot off the presses, I think, research and best practices. And then Michelle Zint, who, among other things, will be talking about watershed education. And then the way this is going to flow is that after our presenters, there's going to be a Q&A and a working session at our tables. That's really the way the whole day is going to work. So there's going to be presentations, question and answer for them, and then working sessions. And we, again, Shannon and Jamie will be talking about how that's going to flow. So that will take us up almost to lunchtime. We're going to have Mark do a brief presentation about a study he did at North Bay, which many of you are familiar with. Then we'll go to lunch downstairs, and in the afternoon we're going to come back and look at some more specific models of EE, and what is it about these models that can lead to, or research shows is leading to, increased stewardship, or in some cases increased academic achievement, environmental quality as well. We're also going to actually hear of a program or a study that looked broadly at green school programs and how they rate success. So. Kicking us off in the afternoon, then, is going to be Trudy Volk and Bill McBeth talking a little bit about the IEEIA model, investigating and evaluating environmental issues and actions. And then Q&A working session, we'll have a break, and then we'll come back and we'll hear from Rachel Becker-Klein. She's going to be talking about community and place-based education, some research behind that. Bo is going to come up and sort of give us an on-the-ground look at some of the place-based education. And then rounding off today is going to be Julian, who's going to be discussing some of his work with green schools and sustainable school rating programs. So that's today. Does anybody have any just overarching logistical questions about that? Great. And I was going to give some notes to folks in the webinar, but they can't hear me.
No, not at the moment. Sorry.
It's all right. Well, then I think we need to jump into the agenda then. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and introduce Nick DePasquale, who's the director of the Chesapeake Bay program. Nick's been director of the Bay program since, was it last year you took over?
Oh, yeah, a little over a year, yeah, a couple days over a year.
So you...
Okay, I'm still here. It's good.
Yeah. Nick is, Nick's truly a man of the water, Jim. So before he came to live and work here in Annapolis, he was the secretary for DENREC, Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, from 1999 to 2002. So he's got Delaware covered. And then in Pennsylvania, he was the deputy secretary of Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the director of Brandywine Conservancy's Environmental Management Center, also in PA. And then most recently, he was back in Delaware with Duffield Associates in Wilmington. And then you're from New York originally, so you've got literally over half the jurisdictions of the watershed. So Nick is bringing with him today a tremendous amount of expertise and experience, and we're really glad he could join us this morning. So please help me welcome me.
And I did an internship in D.C., which is also
yep.
I feel like I should grab my seat if they're only limited numbers.
I can sit also there.
Just kidding. It's kind of noteworthy, I guess, that today's the first day of school, at least in Annapolis, and I got stuck behind a bus coming in. And I was thinking to myself that, you know, these kids are going to school. Hopefully, they're going to have some kind of educational experience that's related to the environment. And really, for the Chesapeake Bay and the entire watershed, we're looking at going on over 25 years, actually, of efforts to restore the bay and its watershed. So that's a generation, and it usually takes a generation, as you all know, to get people kind of educated and understanding the value of the environment. There is a saying that I like to quote, and I think I used it when I introduced the conference in November, that you don't value what you don't know, and you don't protect what you don't value. And I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that our kids know the environment, that they understand the environment, they have experiences, and they come to value it, because then they'll act in a way that's going to protect it ultimately. So the partnership has actually been at this for a while, and I want to just read to you the a directive that was issued back in 1998 that started environmental education off for the watershed. And it was Directive 98-1, if anybody's taking notes. The future well-being of North America's largest and most productive estuary, the Chesapeake Bay, its thousands of tributaries, its 64,000 square miles of watershed will soon rest in the hands of its youngest citizens. These citizens, 3 million strong in kindergarten through 12th grade, are tomorrow's leaders. They also will be the stewards of the bay's precious resources, including fish, crabs, oysters, forests, and wetlands. The work that you're doing is absolutely essential to the success of a lot of these restoration efforts. You know, humans can't seem to figure out how to live on the land. This is kind of paraphrasing the quote, without messing things up. And I think we've seen over the last 25 years that we're getting smarter about the way we deal with runoff. We're getting smarter about the way we deal with pollution. We're starting to figure these things out, and I think when we figure out how to live on the land without messing things up, we'll have productive estuaries again and clean water, and those things will be valued by our children. So as a result of this directive, the Chesapeake Bay Education Work Group was tasked with creating a framework of fostering stewardship about the bay and the millions of K-12. This is something that continues on, obviously establishing the metrics, and I think that's one of the reasons you're all here today, is to figure out how we construct these programs, how we measure their success, whether we know we're succeeding or not. The work group, set out to define what meaningful education was all about for the Bay Watershed. And that sounds like kind of a simple question to ask or a simple statement to make, meaningful watershed experience. But I think when you really look at it, what does that entail exactly? And I think that's what we're wrestling with. We're fortunate that we do have an environmental literacy strategy that's been published. It was published last November. And that from that, we're starting to help define that as well as the metrics. So it was the members of this work group that defined the meaningful watershed educational experience, MeWe. It's an unfortunate acronym, maybe, but that's what we're stuck with. An environmental education best practice blending classroom instruction with field work in a preparation, action, and reflection sequence. I think a lot of the experiences we go through life, especially in this kind of fast-paced electronic world, you really don't get to reflect on what it really means, what it's all about. I know that I start the day at my Annapolis office, and it seems like just a constant run till about 6 o'clock. And you look back and ask yourself, you know, what did you actually accomplish today? I think a lot of us are in that kind of a situation. Things seem to be moving a lot faster than they have in the past. And I think it's important that we stop and actually reflect. And I think teach our children how to do that. Because the only way you can change what you're doing is to reflect on what you're doing ultimately. The MeWe program, if you will, now is being promoted by states, grant programs, and educational organizations far beyond the watershed. We like to think, and I don't want to sound too braggadocious about this, but the Chesapeake Bay program really has kind of led the way in many areas, and I certainly can't take credit for it being here only 1 year. A lot of very talented people, a lot of very committed people. The Dean of Environmental Education, Don Baugh, certainly have blazed the way in the area of environmental education. And we've been at it for a while, and hopefully we're going to be able to pass on what we're doing to others. And we're also, many of you who aren't part of the watershed experience, the Bay watershed experience, have things to teach us as well. So it's a two-way street. But we do, we are government people after all, and we are accountable, and so we have to find ways to measure things. We have to find ways of reporting that suggest that what we're doing is having an impact and it's being effective. The governors of Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, the states that we call the Bay states, there are others obviously, West Virginia, Delaware, and others, along with the mayors of the District of Columbia, have committed themselves, and they've recommitted themselves to providing their students with MeWe's prior to high school graduation. So at those levels in government, there is a commitment to see this thing through. In fact, the Executive Council of the Chesapeake Bay Partnership met recently and took recommendations from the Citizens Advisory Council to formally adopt the environmental literacy strategy and also establish 2-year milestones and metrics. So they're really supportive of this effort, and hopefully we're going to be able to progress in a business-like manner to get the job done. And the federal agencies have a role to play. In the President's 2009 executive order, environmental education was part of that, along with a lot of other goal setting on habitat, clean water, fisheries, and those sorts of things. And it's all integrated. One of the things that I really appreciate about the Chesapeake Bay Partnership is it is ecosystem-based. A lot of our environmental programs, because of the way laws were passed, were air, water, waste. They dealt in a very disciplined way with different kinds of pollution. But the environment doesn't understand that. I mean, I think we all appreciate the fact here that it works in harmony. So any impact you have in one area is going to have an effect in another. And the Chesapeake Bay Partnership really looks at the watershed as an ecosystem. And perhaps it's good that the environmental education effort had its origins, or at least can be responsible for the beginnings of environmental education nationally. But we also know that teachers don't come necessarily to the job equipped with a deep knowledge of environmental issues and how to pass that information along to their students. So there's a lot of work yet to be done. I know a lot of you are here because you understand this is a principal concept that we really need to pass along if we're going to ensure, I don't want to sound too dramatic here, but the survival of the species. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think some of the impacts that we're seeing now are changing, and in fact, polls suggest that about two-thirds of adults, when you ask them, think that the major source of water pollution is industrial waste. And I think everybody in this room at least knows that it comes from runoff. It comes from the water that runs across the land, picks up pollutants, and discharges to the bay. And, you know, back in the 1980s, when the resource conservation law was enacted at the federal level that dealt with hazardous waste, for example, industrial waste, that was really kind of the low-hanging fruit, if you want to look at it that way. We knew what the sources were, we knew who was generating it, we could hold them responsible under these laws. With non-point source pollution, it's a lot more difficult. The sources are, you know, just magnitudes greater. And in fact, each of our households is a source of pollution that affects the water quality. And government doesn't deal real well with small, unregulated sources. So environmental education is going to be the primary way that we make improvements on the land. But we know these problems are not going to be solved by one workshop or one strategy or draft plan. It's going to take a long time in order to get this job done. And I think we've made a great start in that direction. And I'm hopeful that coming out of this workshop today, that we're going to start defining those metrics and applying those to our programs to see how successful they actually are. So I mentioned that the strategy released in November calls upon the educational community to develop and refine programs using the best available research on the effectiveness of environmental education and support continued research in the field. You'll be hearing from experts that are doing this today, and we'll be able to learn from them. We have among us researchers and evaluators from leading nonprofit organizations. I mentioned Don earlier. Don is a huge resource. In fact, I was at two independent conferences recently, and at both of those, they acknowledged and recognized the great work that the Chesapeake Bay Foundation is doing under Don's leadership. So he's a huge resource for all of you, and we can learn from him. I'd also like to recognize a few of the educators who are with us from state programs. They introduced themselves earlier, but if I could embarrass you by just kind of waving your hand when I call out your name. Barb Young, science specialist from Virginia. Gary Hedge, science specialist in Maryland. And Robin Anglin, I didn't see, there she is, okay, science coordinator from West Virginia. The federal government on the education side has its challenges, and I think if we're going to be successful, really, it's working through state departments of education in order to get this work done. I think at the federal level, we can provide some support, we can provide resources, but really the way education operates in this country, it's going to be the state education departments that are going to have to be at the implementation end of things. So what kinds of questions are we going to be asking ourselves today? What kinds of student experiences lead to increases in stewardship traits? I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman who is a promoter, actually, and was a former lobbyist. And he's associated with Expedition Chesapeake in Harrisburg with the Whitaker Center. And, you know, I thought, okay, he's a lobbyist. He's just going to be trying to sell us on something. He's going to be asking for money or whatever. But he said a few things that really made me think. We were at Davis's here in town for lunch. We weren't drinking, just, you know, Maryland crab soup and and lemonade. But he said, you know, he really firmly believes that you have to change, not change habits, but you have to teach children certain things that then become their normal. Just like things that we learned as we were growing up, they became our normal. It's a lot harder when people have, you know, 50, 60 years of existence on this earth. We develop habits about the way we do things, the way we see things. He said, it's a lot harder to change people's habits to get them to do the right thing than it is to teach them what that right thing is right from the beginning. And it becomes children's normal. It's just the stuff they do because that's the way they've been brought up to do it. And even though he was a lobbyist and I had already kind of pigeonholed him in that category, it was something that just kind of rang a bell in my head that that's really, there's a lot of truth in that. So getting to children, giving them information on how they should act in terms of environmental impacts, is really where things need to go. A lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of time has been put into not only the Chesapeake Bay experience, restoration experience, but similar kinds of activities throughout the country. And that's a legacy that's going to need to be carried on. And if we don't have children who kind of pick up the banner behind us and understand that they need to do that just as part of being a person, who lives in a watershed, then we're going to be in big trouble. All of our efforts are going to be for naught. So you guys really are probably the most important cog in all of this. If we don't succeed here, we're not going to succeed in the long term. So I want to thank all of you for attending the workshop. I only will be able to stay with you probably till noon today, and I'll have to get back to some of my other duties, but I really appreciate the work you're doing. And I do want to thank the Science and Technical Advisory Committee, Natalie Gardner here, for sponsoring this workshop, and the Chesapeake Bay Trust for sponsoring the workshop. This is really good stuff, and I hope you have an absolutely productive 2 days. Thank you very much.
Is there a clip or not?
Yep, it should be right
there.
Yep.
Is
the video
working?
It's not right now.
The MeWe video, will that work?
It should.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, AV. I'm Shannon Sprague with NOAA. Just a reminder. Thank you, Nick. That was a great introduction. I can't think of a better way to kick that off and to remind us how important environmental education really is to the grand scheme of protecting and restoring the Chesapeake Bay. So thank you for that. Many of my slides that I'm going to go through, he kind of introduced during his welcome. So I'm going to go through them relatively quickly and then get us to the real work of the day. So if I am a couple minutes before, I don't think I will. That never happens. So. So way back in 2003, the National Science Foundation said this: in the coming decades, the public will more frequently be called upon to understand complex environmental issues, assess risk, evaluate proposed environmental plans, and understand how individual decisions affect the environment at local and global scales. And this is the important part in my mind. Creating a scientifically informed citizenry requires a concerted, systematic approach to environmental education. And as Nick just pointed out, that's what this effort's been doing since 1998, is setting up that concerted, systematic approach to environmental education here in the Chesapeake. Again, don't want to beat a dead horse, but quickly running through the history of environmental education in the region, back in 1998, the Directive 98-1 was signed by the governors. What that essentially did was invite the Departments of Education to become active partners in the Bay program, and also established interagency working groups in each of the jurisdictions. By jurisdiction, we just mean the states plus D.C. In 2000, the Keystone Commitment was endorsed by the governors. That was to provide every student in the watershed with a meaningful watershed educational experience, or the unfortunate acronym MeWe. prior to graduation. Most states at this point have a elementary, middle, and high school component to that. And in 2002, BUET was established, but this is the point where we're going to switch over to video.
Okay.
So this is, what does it mean? What do we mean when we say
this? This isn't the one that I made, is it?
It is. Listen, Kevin's
actors. If you try to click it one more time and see if that does, okay. I'm sorry, not quite sure.
It's actually not, it's the link.
If you,
it's not embedded. It's okay. Don't worry about it. We will come back to that later. It'll be a lunchtime. We'll kick off the afternoon. So, forward to it. So, what is a MIWI? The experiences are investigative, are project oriented. They should consist of preparation, action, the outdoor action component, and reflection, analysis, and reporting in the classroom. They're an integral part of the instructional program, meaning that they are part of what the students are learning in the classroom. They're also part of a sustained activity. That means that they don't just happen once. They happen over the course of a semester or hopefully a year, and then they occur throughout a student's academic tenure. They consider the watershed as a system, so we don't have to necessarily go out in the bay. They can talk about land issues, they can talk about any number of important environmental issues, but they talk about it in the context of an earth system. They involve external sharing and communication, so the students have to tell people about, and their community, about what they learned. They're enhanced by natural resource personnel, and they are for all students. People with special needs, gifted students, English is second language, all students need to be exposed to this. The MIWI evaluation, we have Michaela and Anita with us today who completed this evaluation for us. It was to determine if this model actually increases stewardship ethic and academic achievement of students. It was funded by NOAA, the Trust, as well as Keith Campbell Foundation. And what we learned is that it works, in essence. Students receiving this sort of experience do increase their intention to act, knowledge of issues, and knowledge of actions that they can take to engage and protect the watershed. Teachers also increase their confidence in being able to go outdoors and deliver this sort of experience, and they're more likely to do it, so win-win there. In 2002, NOAA BUET started, and that was, up until that point, MIWI was an unfunded mandate. It said, we should do this, and states were like, great. We don't have any money. So BUET started as a $3.5 million program in a good year, more likely in recent years about a $2 million federal program. It has been consistently funded since 2002, so it has provided a consistent source of funding for this meaningful watershed educational experience. The grants are generally about $75,000 to about $200,000, and it's evolved over time to really look at system implementation, so at the local education agencies, really getting them to do system-wide implementation of the meaningful watershed educational experience. 2005, we said, okay, we need to figure out who's doing this, where is it happening? In 2008-2009, about 80% of students were getting this sort of experience, and you can see the blue right there is Maryland, the green is Pennsylvania, and the yellow is Virginia. This looks great, right? About 80% of 3 million students, that's good. But states are using different tracking mechanisms. It's also unclear if the people that were responding to these surveys actually understood what we were asking, if they really knew what a meaningful watershed educational experience was, or were the kids just going outside on their schoolyard, which is great, but not really part of that comprehensive program that we're looking for. And also the quality of experiences were highly variable. We had no way of really looking at, how deep was that experience that the students were getting. 2010, we had the executive order. It wasn't in the proclamation signed by President Obama in 2009, but in 2010, the implementation strategy fixed that. And there was a whole citizen stewardship component that asked us to develop this environmental literacy strategy. And I think you all have a copy of that on your table. And what did this strategy do? It significantly expands federal support for the environmental literacy efforts and the meaningful watershed educational experience here. We went around and we sat down people like Maria Arnold in the back and any number of people, NASA, NOAA, NSF, and we said, what do you have that can support environmental education in our schools? We inventoried that, and then we came up with strategies for getting that to the states. So it really looks at that federal-state interaction and says, how can we do a better job at that? And it also recognizes that in order to implement an effective, meaningful watershed educational experience strategy, it's not just about the students. It's about the educators, it's about the students, and it's about the school environment. Again, these are on your table. The goals and outcomes are on the table. But it looks at those students, those educators, those schools, and then also us. How do we as an education community come together to do things like these best practices, metrics, and things that are important to support this effort? This is not just a federal effort. It's not just a state effort. It's everybody working together. It is NAAA affiliate groups. It's state departments of education and natural resource agencies. It's the U.S. Department of Education, who hopefully right now she's logged onto the webinar. She can be here in person today. It's federal natural resource agencies as well, all working together towards a common set of goals and outcomes. So that strategy that you have in front of you, the goals and outcomes we've all bought into together. I have a signature page that shows everybody who's bought into that set of goals and outcomes. Then, we all have different strategies. So there's a role that the federal government plays. There's a role that the states play. There's a role that the NAAA affiliates and other nonprofits can play in that. So we have individual strategies that we've developed to support that. And then down here at the bottom, these shared metrics. That's what we're here to talk about today. We want to have the shared metrics because we all know what you're tracking is ultimately what you're doing. It's what guiding what you're doing anyway. The NAAA Mid-Atlantic groups came together. That's the Mayo, VRUEC, DCEEC, PAE, West Virginia, all of the states. Environmental Education Association is essentially what that is. They came up and said, okay, we have these common goals and outcomes, and they actually helped us develop those as well. Now what are we doing? So there's the strategy that they just put out in the summer of 2012 that says what they're going to do. It largely focuses on implementation and program development, mostly teacher professional development, school greening, and then how are they going to do outdoor student programs. Also, the Bay Trust has a new EPA award that is going to help support that effort in providing capacity building grants to organizations working on priorities such as that. Also, 47 states around the country, and somebody here knows way more about the number and where we are with this than I do, Don and others. But around that amount, they're working on developing their state environmental literacy plan. So that's almost everyone, right? Almost everyone around the country is thinking about this sort of thing, which is a pretty exciting time to be in environmental education. Back in 2008, NAAA put together this document. I have a copy of it back on my table if anybody needs to reference it during the course of this workshop. But it said this is what a state environmental literacy program should have in it. I didn't do that
right. I didn't even try.
So what does that look like here in the Mid-Atlantic region? Maryland has had theirs in place since 2009. They also have the associated graduation requirement in place just from last year, and they're talking about what does that mean now. And there have been a series of meetings with school, local education agencies and school divisions trying to figure out what does that look like. There's rubrics in place. Gary just hosted a very exciting conference at the beginning of August with all the LEAs coming together and talking about, okay, we have this requirement, now what do we do? How do we meet that requirement? District of Columbia, yay, theirs went up to the City Council in June 2012. Congratulations, Chris. I don't know, has it been signed off yet?
As far as I know, it's just there. It was, and we're working on implementation of it. So.
Okay. Wonderful, wonderful. So that's very exciting news. Pennsylvania also this summer established theirs and in August, just last month, and Jack is on that group, Jack Barster back in the back. Delaware's is coming October 1. I hear that it's finished. It's just waiting for Richard Louvre to come and say that it's finished. So that's an exciting thing happening October 1st. Virginia has a longstanding environmental education business plan that they've been updating to kind of meet the same goals and outcomes of the Mid-Atlantic strategy, so that's exciting. And West Virginia's starting down that path as well, so it's very exciting. And they have a green school certification program that they have they've started to pull together and submitted some things to the U.S. Green Ribbon Schools program. So that's a very exciting work going on in West Virginia as well. Keith is speaking. I can't. I don't have control anymore.
Sorry, I'm not sure what happened.
Maybe just click on it. So now what? Why are we here? So what we want to do is refine the meaningful watershed educational experience definition based upon the best practices that we're going to start the conversation about today. And we want to refine that meaningful watershed educational experience with respect to those students, educators, and schools. So right now it's primarily focused on students and what students need to do, but we want to broaden that. We understand that it takes all those components to really graduate environmentally literate students. We also need to establish metrics or indicators, whatever word you'd like to use, or tracking systems or whatever, to figure out how the meaningful watershed educational experience best practices are being implemented, where are they being implemented, you know, and provide a little bit of granularity to just, are they getting meaningful watershed educational experiences? We want to ask some questions with respect to what sorts of experiences are the students getting? What do the schools have? You know, what sorts of professional development are the teachers getting? And then also, we need a plan for getting the tools and training out to the educators to make sure that these are being implemented. Any questions on that? We just wanted to make sure everybody had kind of a common understanding of where we've been and where we're going. Jamie's going to really start to go through what do the products look like and what are we going to work on in the next couple of days. But any questions about the background before I retreat to my seat in the back before someone takes me?
When you have the meaningful water, what's the first E? The last
Wee wee.
Yes, I mean, you have the
educational.
For the states that are doing this full blown, is it all students, all grade levels, where necessary, being transported from their schools to a place where they're at a creek or a stream or a bay to experience this? Or are they being modified somehow for students who do not have ready access to those kinds of water features?
I think, and Gary and Barb, you can certainly provide more detail, but in general, there is a recognition that every student every year, even in the state of Maryland, cannot mean transportation to a field experience, you know, a bay experience that is just cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. So they are, you know, using the school grounds and other opportunities that you can walk to in order to really make a full suite of 13 or more experiences over a student's career. Barb?
I was just going to say, in Virginia, what we're trying to do is say that every student in elementary will have at least one really good, meaningful watershed.
In their entire elementary?
In their elementary career. And in elementary, we focus more on the schoolyard, the environment around the school. Middle school, they once again will have an experience, and we do try to have some kind of a, it could be a stream that's very close to the school, but it could also entail travel, and same with the high school. We realize, we try to, it's aligned with our curriculum, with our standards within the state, and so that they're not getting the same thing every year. You know, that it's a progressional type of thing. So.
I'm the last one to offer a comment about this, but let me throw this out. Under the Clean Water Act 319 grants, you can actually get funding to support the installation of things like rain gardens at schools. And not only does it end up being a meaningful experience for the kids, because they help design it, they do the plantings, they see how you're redirecting stormwater, but it actually ends up being obviously a good thing for the environment. I was involved in a number of projects when I was with a consulting firm over in Delaware, where that funding was used at schools and libraries to put in rain gardens, and usually in older towns that don't have a stormwater system, it's a straight shot to the water body. Redirecting that to a rain garden is good for the local environment.
Any last questions before I hand it over to Jane? Okay, then I'd like to introduce Jamie Baxter. He works over at the Bay Trust, but he has, I guess, long roots in environmental education, having worked for 8 years at the Bay Foundation, and then did a stint over at Maryland Department of Natural Resources in tributary planning and strategies. So,
all right, thank you, Shannon.
Good work. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
The fire hose of information is starting to crank. It's going to be a day of a lot of information, and I think Shannon's little background is very helpful in just kind of getting a little bit of the history. I'm going to very briefly walk through how we're going to try to manage this overflow of water and information that we're going to get. Just very quickly, Jamie Baxter, Chesapeake Bay Trust. My colleague Casey Wetzel is also here. Our partners in crime when it comes to the work that we do to support environmental education. For those who aren't familiar with the Trust, the really short version of who we are is we are a quasi-public entity. We were created by the Maryland State Legislature to pool public and private funds to support environmental education and community engagement in a variety of different environmental programs. And so we have been around doing this for over 25 years, pretty much from the first dollar that we had until now. We have supported schools, teachers, and school systems directly in their work to integrate the environment and in the learning for their students. That has evolved quite a bit over time. Some of you may have been around to know when we were twisting people's arms to take our money and do great things with their kids, and that's certainly changed now, and that's a good thing. And we're constantly also looking for opportunities as a grant maker primarily to help those folks who are doing the great work with our fund, do it better, do it more, and to be more effective at it. And so a lot of my work is in building the capacity of all those folks and providing those resources so that they can do that. And this workshop, our role in developing the best practices and most importantly in thinking about how to apply these kinds of practices out in the work that we do, that's very much lockstep in our role as a grant maker in helping build the capacity and increase the effectiveness of all the programs that are out there. We also fund a variety of other things I'm not going to talk about right now. So this is always one of those double-edged swords when you're in a room full of evaluators to throw up some kind of a map of boxes and arrows. Either we'll be comforted by it and feel like you're at home, or you'll want to give me the hook and throw me out the door for some reason or another for all the things that you see that are wrong with it. But in our efforts to try to make sense of what we're trying to accomplish today, we've been around sort of the basis of 100 times or more. And we wanted to try to boil it down into a couple of short statements that I think you'll hear repeatedly. But that is that for the premise of this workshop and the work that we support, what we're interested in is student environmental literacy, student stewardship, right? The outcomes of student environmentally responsible behaviors are ultimately where we're looking or what we're looking for. On the front end of that are a whole host of different environmental education programs, experiences, activities that may target the school itself. They may target a school system and how they operate and where they intervene. Or in the case of a traditional meaningful watershed education experience, the MeWe definition, you know, they really are targeting students directly. They're providing a direct educational experience for a group of students. And perhaps the teacher's part of that, perhaps they're not. But it's important for us as we think about our work moving forward that we really, if we're going to get to those environmental literacy, student environmental literacy outcomes, as Shannon stated, it really is more than just those programs that work directly with students. There are programs that work with teachers. There are programs that work with schools. And all of those are important to achieving those student outcomes. And to date, we've really just tracked those direct experiences, and we really just thought about the MeWe definition as strictly being a direct student experience, which is important, but we also know it's just a small piece of what is a really broad set of things that are going on out there. And so in setting up for this workshop, we said, well, one, we're assuming that all the programming going on out there is doing everything it can possibly do under its, you know, current resources and knowledge to achieve those literacy outcomes, student literacy outcomes. one. And so first we wanted to kind of revisit that. What do we know about the linkages between different programs and student stewardship outcomes? And that's where the best practices come in. Secondly, we wanted to recognize that programs are working at various scales. They have different audiences. We have to fully recognize that and to see whether or not there are best practices that are similar or different as you work at those different scales. And that in getting to that student outcome, you are looking at sort of sub outcomes around teachers or around schools, or perhaps your program is focused on a whole host of different things that you're looking to achieve, some of which may happen at those scales. And so we wanted to step back and say, not only what are those best practices working there, but also what are the possible indicators and or metrics that we could be looking at that would help us with identifying really a practical proxy, for lack of a better word, to knowing whether or not we're achieving those student stewardship outcomes. And I say that because it's an important point to make, in that you're going to hear, I think, a lot of information about folks who have actually gone in and attempted to measure the impact of a particular series of interventions on individual student changes of one kind or another, right? And that is essential in this work, in any work you're doing in education, to knowing more about what the impact of programs are. But for our purposes, we're recognizing and going ahead and saying that we're not going to be able to do that at scale. That it's either cost prohibitive. Bill McBeth is shaking his head back there saying, I know this full well. It's important, but it's cost prohibitive and time consuming and certainly resource intensive. And so, as my colleagues in Maryland know, we're not talking about testing students here to assess environmental literacy. That is not the metric or the assessment that we hope to end up with at the end of the day. What we're looking for are those best practices and then some practical ways in which we can assess, essentially, for lack of a better word, whether we're meeting those best practices and then make some assumptions about what sorts of outcomes might be accomplished from there. So what are the products? Well, Shannon pretty much stated these. I'm going to say them briefly again. You know, one is from these 2 days, which will be working 2 days. We're going to open these doors because at some point this room is going to get small for all of us really cranking on this and our brains chewing away. What we want to have are some real rough draft best practices. We have a lot of information that's going to get assembled. We'll have a presentation very shortly that kind of set us off, I think, in a very good start. And two, we want to surface the world of indicators and or metrics that are out there that we could look at as these proxies to student stewardship. So those are really the two immediate products leaving this workshop from tomorrow on. From there, really, as Kevin said, a whole lot of work, I think, will begin. And that is that information will directly inform an updated definition of this meaningful watershed education experience, which is the sort of the commitment that brings us together today and the great work that's really represented out there. In addition to that, some of those, you know, sort of improved or enhanced or simply modified tracking methods. In addition to that, there are going to be a whole host of other uses, many of which probably will have, in some way, more impact, more meaning, more significance than just that MeWe definition piece. And that is, one is we hope that this is applied into the development and implementation of programs. And so we're going to be really looking for opportunities to develop the tools, the training, the resources, the ways in which this information that comes from this gets actually integrated within the programs, whether it's through the informal EE providers or through the formal providers, in such a way that improves the efficacy of the work that's going on out there. And really generally, but also specifically, we've been partnering with the education community for quite some time now in helping them improve their capacity to evaluate what they do, to know whether or not what they're doing is having the desired impacts that they hoped and intended. We very much see the information coming from that as really providing a foundational set of, I think, resources to continue that work and to partner with all those folks doing this so that they can be better evaluators of their own programs. and that perhaps this will provide a nice consistent level of things that we want to know about our programs that we could implement more broadly. And then there could be any number of other uses that I think could come from this, and including just the vast amount of learning, I think, that each of us, and especially me, will have after these 2 days. So that's the products. How are we going to do it? Today, I think Kevin mentioned this briefly, we're set up by our listening groups. You can negotiate a switch if you need to, feel you really need to be in a different group. We're divided into those three categories that the regional literacy plan is divided, and also sort of those key audiences that we know are important: students, teachers, schools. Each of your tables has a facilitator. If they haven't identified themselves already, they will very shortly. And we need each table to make sure somebody's jotting down notes. And when I say notes, in part I'm referring to this sheet, which there should be a stack of these on each of your tables. And just to kind of help you begin to parse out that fire hose of information I talked about, which is going to come at you pretty heavily, we came up with a discussion or a listening worksheet, we called it. And what you have here, depending on which group you're in, whether it's students, teachers, or schools, it'll say at the top, is we pulled from, in the case of the student group, we pulled from the definition of the meaningful watershed education experience. What is it that defines this experience, right? And in a sense, that definition is the same as essentially best practices for meaningful watershed education experiences. We went ahead and we plugged some of those sort of main concepts in. We did that for teachers, and we did that with schools. Again, just as a way to kind of help you in your initial train of thought. And then for each of the panels of presenters, we have a way to keep score, essentially. Not that we're really keeping score, but you know what I mean. And that is that, you know, based on that statement, did you hear something that supported it? If it supported it so much so it would be deemed essential, make a note, it's essential. If you heard it partially, but you're not quite sure, it's still unclear in your head, then it's probably recommended still, right? We still certainly want to do it. It seems good, particularly if it's good for a number of other reasons. If you heard something that really didn't support it at all, that was somehow, you know, you could make that direct connection, certainly this is an opportunity to make a note there. And then perhaps most importantly, if you heard anything that seemed important or seemed salient to you, you can record it here as well and take note of it. And so as we're listening, you can try to keep up and take jot some notes. And then we'll have a Q&A, as Kevin said briefly, for sort of points of clarification and further understanding. And then we'll break, and hopefully we'll have about 20 or so, or maybe more minutes with each table to sort of step back and say, what did you hear? What did you hear from that presentation, those panels, or that particular panel that supports, that makes it essential, that's recommended, or what was different, new, etc. And this is just a first step to begin to kind of decompress some of the information that you just heard. We're going to do that after each of the panels, and then at the end of the day, we'll have sort of a full group report out from each of the perspectives, students, teachers, schools, to sort of say, here's kind of a quick summary of what we're thinking, and what we heard, and what questions we might have. And then I'm not going to talk about day two extensively until tomorrow, but tomorrow we will start with an overview of the National Literacy Assessment and its implications for this work. We'll have a reality check of what's happening in schools. And then basically we will have two significant working sessions, one on the best practices piece, which is listening and lock what we draw from today, and then one on surfacing those indicators and metrics. And then a conclusion, and then we'll go. And most importantly, I forgot, I should have put a slide in of the rooftop at the Metropolitan, but everyone is welcome to a reception after today across the street at the Metropolitan. Unwind and decompress.
Opening it just for us.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. So that is it. Any questions or suggestions for me on our goals and objectives in the process?
I have a clarification.
Yes.
On this sheet, are these best practices which have been accumulated or derived to date and for which you're trying to either get some sort of yay or nay? And I notice there's spaces to add more. What are these?
For the student ones, there's a more direct correlation really between the NIWI definition, right, and what's listed there. For the teacher in school, it's just a compilation of what might already be out there.
But you're looking for best practices.
We are, and this was more just to get, so we weren't starting from scratch, because we really aren't starting from scratch.
Right.
So we just, and this isn't exhaustive by any extent of your imagination, but it's just a starting place, and it pulls mostly from the NAAEE guidelines, and other things that have come our way, and to some extent from the criteria we use in our various grant programs, the BWET grant program to evaluate teacher professional development. You know, all of those are generally based on a set of best practices that have been accumulated.
Okay.
But there is no official context for the teacher school one.
Right. Okay.
Does that answer your
question?
That's
fine. Thank you.
So, that said, I'm going to get us started, and I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Bora. Oh, you're going to do that? Or dropping me?
Sit down.
I'm going to do it. I know I'm going to take my
seat.
Take us away.
Hey, by the way, there aren't any, you'll notice this morning, there aren't any breaks mixed in here. So, bathroom's right around the corner. I think we got coffee snacks out there. So please use that. So right now I want to bring up Bora Sinnott. Bora is the director for the National Project for Excellence in Environmental Education at the University of Oregon. Bora, what watershed do you live in? Put you on the spot.
Well, it's the Willamette.
The Willamette. I'm going to keep it running.
McKinsey, because the two rivers come together.
Bora gets the award for coming, I think,
farthest
today. More than 15 years, she has led the effort on behalf of NAAEE to design, develop, and implement several volumes of the Guidelines for Excellence in Environmental Education, and she brought some. She's going to be talking about those. The guidelines are a bridge between formal and non-formal education communities, providing a pedagogy research for those who have the environmental content knowledge, but not necessarily the skills or methods to convey that knowledge to a variety of audiences. So she's going to sort of lay the groundwork for what those are. Thank you, Bora.
Welcome.
Here.
Yes,
clicker.
Right up there. Thank you. Okay, we'll try to see if this works. Technology and I do not get along in real way.
Apparently me either.
So what they asked me to chat about and what seems to have been my life for the last 15 years or so, or 20 years, is the National Project for Excellence in Environmental Education, which is an initiative of the North American Association for Environmental Education. And one of the things that I always love to start off any presentation with is to honor the fact that we have not done this alone, and that we've gotten substantial funding over the years from US EPA, particularly in the Office of Environmental Education, and we're currently being funded through EPA and something called the EE Capacity, which is housed at Cornell University right now. But we also have had a lot of partners throughout the years, and just wanted to sort of note that we've had a strong partnership with the Wildlife Service and the Forest Service and with NEAF. And the State Environmental Education Associations have been strong supporters and important to this project over the years, as well as lots and lots of other groups like PLT and Keep America Beautiful and all of those sorts of things. The overarching notion for NAAEE, the North American Association, is this idea of promoting excellence in environmental education, that we are a membership organization and we're really about building the profession. And that's really been the touchstone for this particular project within. within is how can we promote excellence in environmental education? And as been mentioned, through the project, we've developed five different documents that I just always use my little shorthand. Don't you love it that we all have our own little, you know, little acronyms and all of that. So I just call it the Guidelines for Excellence, or the Guidelines, and then people have to figure out what in the world I'm talking about. But we've developed these various documents in the series, and I'll go through them quickly, but focusing on primarily on the ones that have to do with K-12. But the notion behind these guidelines, if you haven't been involved with it over the years, we started the project in the mid-1990s. It was really initiated in 1993-94. And the whole idea was to try to pull together our collective wisdom as environmental educators. So we developed the guidelines, each one of these five different documents, and we're in the process of developing a sixth right now, is we developed it through a public participatory process. What we always did, we started with research and the literature that was out there, and because that notion of that, well, we really don't want to sort of assume that nothing has come before. There's been a huge amount within environmental education. So we looked at the research, we synthesized that, pulled together a variety of stakeholders, a variety of people across the country who had different areas of expertise, and we called them the writing team. And many of those folks would have multiple hats, and they would come to the writing team with these multiple hats, look at the research, look at that literature, and come up with a very first broad kind of outline. And then we would send that outline out for review, get comments back, revise, send it out for review, revise, and keep going and going. I always like to say that we always sort of kept going until, for the most part, and there were always, you know, the folks who didn't like some part of it, but for the most part, we were starting to get more of the editorial comments. You should use which there, not that. That is why I hire an editor. I personally have never met a comma that I do not love. I put commas everywhere. You know, a sentence has 15 commas in it. The editor goes through and takes them all out. So we did this sort of critique and consensus, review and, you know, comment process through it. And literally thousands of people across the country. And because NAAE has an international audience, we actually got a lot of comments internationally too. So that was the process in developing all of these different sets of guidelines. But these other two pieces here sort of developed over time as being important to what the project has been. Is that we really were trying through this process to engage educators in a deep discussion about our profession, about what it is that we want to accomplish and how we want to accomplish it. And I think that's what this is all about for these two days. It's about really thinking about what do we know, what do we think we know, and where do we want to go with it. Really digging down deep into what we're hoping to accomplish and how to accomplish it the best we can. And then the third piece is to try to develop us as a profession and to really keep us thinking about our best practices and what we want to try to accomplish. In the process of all of this, we sort of came up with this notion of what were some of the overarching thoughts behind environmental education, and we just called them the underpinnings because it sort of sounded good. But it was that notion, first the notion of systems, and I've already heard that this morning, is that environmental education is about understanding systems, and it's about systems thinking and trying to help people to really be able to engage the systems around us. interdependence, that the notion that we as humans are interdependent with our environment, and making sure that all of the different players are really thinking about that interdependence. The importance of where one lives, that we want to start locally, we want to start with our own schools, our own neighborhoods, our own cities, our watersheds, and moving out into the world and getting to that global notion. That environmental education is something that is integrated and infused, particularly when we're talking about pre-K through 12 instruction, that somebody already was talking about, I think you were talking about, the notion that the environment isn't in some little silo, you know, that we aren't in this sort of like, well, here's the physical science, and now we move over here, and here's this little bit, and now we move over here. It's all connected. That notion that for the curriculum, that environmental education is infused and integrated across the curriculum. Roots in the real world, that again, particularly when we're thinking about learners and the next item of being lifelong learning, whether that learner is 3 years old or 80 years old, that it's hopefully something that's experiential, that it's tactile, that it's about the real world and getting people out into the real world. I'm going to run through very quickly a couple of the documents just so you know what they are and sort of what's in them. I brought a few copies of each one of these, and then we have a copy of the K-12 guidelines for everybody. The first of the guidelines that we developed had to do with our instructional materials. And so the notion behind it was we all either develop instructional materials for environmental education, we advise others about instructional materials for environmental education, or we use instructional materials, one way or the other. And whether it's something big and national like Project Learning Tree, or it's something that a school has developed for their own schoolyard, a schoolyard habitat study, that the notion was is to sort of provide some guidance, some key characteristics of what good quality environmental education instructional materials would look like. And so that was just the philosophy behind it. And just to give you an idea of how each of these is laid out, we use slightly different terminology along the way, but in this particular case, it's divided out into six key characteristics. The first one, fairness and accuracy. Surprise, surprise. We would certainly hope that our materials are fair, that they're accurate, that any facts, data, all those sorts of things are in place properly. So it's key characteristics and then guidelines that sort of flesh that out a little bit, and then indicators that try to say, ah, this is what it might begin to look like. So it's just as an example of how each of the sets of documents is laid out. Another one of those sets of guidelines has to do with us, with environmental educators. And it has to do with what are the competencies that an environmental educator should be developing. And we're thinking in terms of the preparation, so people as they're going through their teacher education programs, or certainly as we went around the room, I'm assuming that many of you did not go through teacher preparation. You probably came into environmental education through perhaps wildlife or natural resources, or as many of my graduate students came in from, oh, an undergraduate degree in photography. So people come into environmental education in a lot of different ways. And this set of guidelines, and I know that there's a couple of them strewn about the room, they're trying to set out what are some of those competencies? What is it that we would hope that an environmental educator is developing in terms of what they know and are able to do? as they try to develop programs, as they try to implement programs. And not necessarily just with children, so again, the broad base of environmental educators. It was mentioned that we've tried to do some of the bridging between the formal sector of environmental education and non-formal environmental education. So we developed a set of guidelines that really try to lay out the program development cycle. So for a non-formal educator who's trying to develop an environmental education program, what are some of the types of things that we would hope they would think about? And the very first one happens to be, did you do a needs assessment? Are you, you know, does anyone actually need your program? Is this the best audience for your program? And so it goes from the needs assessment all the way through the notion, the various notions of trying to develop your materials and trying to make sure that your audience is in place and can get to your program and all of those kinds of things, and that you're safe and such. Our newest set of guidelines has to do with early childhood. So what we're looking at there is 3-year-olds to 6-year-olds. And what are the key characteristics, again, of a quality early childhood environmental education program? And this set of guidelines was really developed, again, for this sort of dual audience. What we were hoping to speak to were environmental educators who may well be reaching out to early childhood, or those preschools are coming to their center, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my, they're very little. And what do I do, because they're very little? Or they're going to the preschool center and developing some sort of program with them. So trying to give some guidance around what is developmentally appropriate instruction and all of those sorts of things. But also for the preschool. So we've actually been starting to do some work with Head Start. And the notion is that they have their mission. They have a very important mission. But a lot of those folks really do want to connect more with nature and have the children connect with nature. So how can that preschool or that early childhood center or program or daycare center start to develop something that's going to incorporate more about the environment? So that's what this set of guidelines is all about. And I may as well let the cat out of the bag here. It's officially going to be announced at the NAAE conference, is that an outgrowth of this and some of the partnerships that we've developed with this set of guidelines, NAAE is putting together and hopefully publishing next spring the first issue of the International Journal for Early Childhood Environmental Education. Yeah. So we have peer reviewed, we have consulting editors in place, and our notion is to have it online and be free so that it's truly accessible, because we understand that early childhood is one of those, it's a very dispersed type of group of folks. That's an exciting piece. So this is the piece that I want to spend the most time on, is the Excellence in Environmental Education Guidelines for Learning K through 12. So the notion behind this set of guidelines is that they were developed first during the height of the standards development movement. So those of you who were around in education in the 90s, and you saw the development of the science education standards, and actually the late 80s with the mathematics standards, but the civics and the history, and you know, there's about 11 or 12 sets of national standards, economics, fine arts, geography. And we went about developing these at about that same time, and we modeled them the best we could after what some of those national efforts were doing, so that part of our whole notion was to make sure that we were developing a document that could describe what it was that we hoped an environmentally literate student would be, would know and be able to do, to use the standards language. We wanted them to be, sort of the language of the standards, but we didn't want to call them that for all sorts of political reasons at the time. But a set of guidelines for environmental education, setting expectations, so benchmarked at 4th grade, 8th grade, and 12th grade, that it would give a framework for schools to develop that infused, integrated environmental education experience throughout the K-12 schooling. But also could be picked up by non-formal education programs so that they could be looking at, well, what might be some of the types of learner expectations. And one of the really big pieces for this whole effort was that we wanted to try to demonstrate, because even by the mid-1990s, and certainly now it's even more ensconced, is that environmental education needs to be rooted in a way that it's compatible with, supportive of the standards and the standards-based curriculum. Most schools in the U.S. and teachers in the U.S. don't have the luxury to ignore state standards. And so our notion was that we needed to be able to show how environmental education could support those state standards and support the traditional school curriculum. So what we ended up with was what we called strands, four big ideas. And I'll go through a little bit more detail about each one of these. But starting with questioning types of skills, knowledge about environmental processes and systems, skills for understanding and addressing environmental issues, and then personal and civic responsibility. So those are the big four ideas. And this is just a page of the document. And again, you're all going to get a copy of it, so don't worry about it. There's the strand. Sometimes strands are subdivided further. So the idea was that a strand was the really big idea, and then there might be some need to sort of divide it down a little bit more, and then guidelines to get more into the level of this is what we hope that the students know or are able to do related to it. And then the bulleted pieces are indicators again. What is it that a student might be doing if they've developed that skill? What is it that a student might be showing you if they have that understanding, they've developed it, developed that concept? And then over here on the left-hand side, again, we were very, very explicit when we started this whole project of trying to tie it into the national standards, because we wanted it to be just sort of, no, you don't have to think too hard about this. There is a connection. So what we did was, if in this particular one, it has to do with processes that shape the earth. So it's about Earth as a physical system. And if you looked at Geography for Life, which are the National Geographic standards on those pages, and if you looked at the AAAS benchmarks, the original thing on those pages, you're going to find a standard that is pretty similar to that. Not word for word, necessarily. We wouldn't want to plagiarize. But, you know, pretty close. And Changes in Matter, you're going to, on the National Science Education Standards, you would have found that in AAAS again. And if you go through all of these, the guidelines, you end up seeing that there's lots of connections in English language arts and into mathematics and into the fine arts and economics and social studies and such. So let me just walk you through quickly a little more about the framework and sort of how we you know, how it's envisioned in terms of what we're hoping that these students are learning and able to do. And the very first, and quite deliberately that we put it as our very first strand, was this notion of questioning, analysis, and interpretation skills. That we were hoping that students in environmental education, and we have a strong belief that for a person to be environmentally literate, that they really needed to be able to develop these skills. They needed to be able to develop really good questioning skills and apply them. Go out into the yard, and when they come in from recess, are there recesses anymore? There weren't anymore, on the part I was in. But come back in and say, it rained, and there's worms out. Where did the worms come from? And have the students be able to generate their own questions about the world around them, and then design investigations that relate to their own questions, be able to collect whatever information that relates to it, evaluate the accuracy and reliability of that information that they're collecting. It's interesting because this framework was sort of developed primarily and begun in the mid-90s and towards the end of the 90s. And we were seeing that, you know, sort of the evaluating the accuracy and reliability and sort of thinking more in terms of kind of that classic thing of, did you collect the information the way you were supposed to collect the information or the data? And now with Google and just being able to throw things into the internet and things pop up, that this actually starts to become so much more important and broad in terms of, especially if you're asking students to go off and look at some of the, you know, social sorts of investigations, but certainly scientific information too, of just how do we know that this is good quality information that we're using? But how do you go about organizing that information, working with models and simulations, and then drawing the conclusions from it? And I'll give you just a really quick little story with this, is that we, in our process of developing this, I was trotting out the framework to various folks around the country, and I would go to NSTA, and I would go to the National Council for the Social Studies and these various conferences and such. And this strand was originally named Inquiry. And that, you know, kind of describes inquiry in a lot of ways. Normally when I would put it up there, the science teachers would say, the scientific method. And I'd say, well, yeah, we want to call it a little bit broader than that. And when we called it inquiry and we took it off to the social studies teachers, they would sit there and go, yeah, that's great stuff. That's really important. That's what science teachers do. So we renamed it. And all of a sudden people could see themselves. English teachers can see themselves in this. Art teachers can see themselves in this. So it's important in the language that we were trying to use. The second strand gets into a lot of what probably most people in environmental education or most people in education when they think about environmental education really sort of think of, and especially the first two substrands here. So strand two is all about Earth's or the environmental processes and systems. And so, of course, the first, Earth is a physical system, so understanding all those things about water cycles and oceans and, you know, all of that stuff as being really important. The living environment as being obviously incredibly important, but also getting into humans and their societies. So understanding that we as humans have all sorts of systems. We have economic systems and cultural systems and political systems. And that all of that combines together with how we as humans impact the environment and are impacted by the environment. And trying to really see it as one big system. And knowing that systems have subsystems and interconnection and all of that. The third strand really gets into the issue investigation piece of this. So if you think the first strand is about those question and analysis skills, those could easily be applied to just everyday phenomena that someone is going to run into out into the world. And they're not necessarily about problems, and they're not necessarily about issues. It's just about asking good questions of what's going on out in our world. What we were trying to do with strand three was get at this notion that we really need to help people develop skills to analyze environmental issues, that they need to be able to define them and analyze them and investigate them. And that then, as they go through that process of analyzing environmental issues, then they need another set of skills that have to do with being able to make good decisions. And this is probably the strand that people have the most difficulty with. And we still run into a lot of schools that say, I'm fine with questions, I'm fine with learning about Earth as a physical system, the living environment, cool, that's great. The social studies stuff, we start to get a little bit like, oh, that might get us into controversial territory. This, a lot of teachers have a hard time with it, just because they are so fearful of the controversy that it might raise. And my argument, and I think what you're going to hear from some of the other folks is that if we prepare our educators well to be able to, and they have these skills, because that's a pretty big first assumption, that we have these skills, and that then we work with the students to develop these skills, then the controversy in a lot of ways melts away, because it's the students are generating the questions and the students are investigating. And if they're truly investigating it in terms of looking at multiple perspectives and all of those skills, that a lot of the controversy sort of disappears. Doesn't disappear, but at least it is lessened. But I do think that this notion of the decision-making skills and how you go about being able to decide what needs to happen to help solve a particular issue or what needs to happen in order to prevent a particular issue, that those skills are essential. And then the fourth, my little dirty secret is that I was originally a social studies teacher. So for me, the notion of civics is really, really huge. The notion of this strand has to do with personal and civic responsibility. And it's a little bit different from the others, and it's almost more in the realm of the disposition. There's a lot of cognitive piece in here in how they were written, but it's understanding that there are societal values out there and principles, recognizing our rights and responsibilities as citizens, and particularly as citizens in a democracy. What does it mean to be a citizen in a democracy? The whole notion of efficacy, and that whole notion of that what I do matters, and having students in particular having opportunities to really reflect on that and think about it. And then accepting that personal responsibility. Because what I do matters, and so if I choose not to do something, that is an action. And if I choose to do something, that is an action. And so taking, accepting that responsibility, reflecting on what it is that we do. So just as a, that's sort of the quickie of the framework itself, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit that of different ways that it's being used. We've created some crosswalks, just matrices, that show the connections between this framework and the ocean literacy, climate literacy, and energy literacy principles. A lot of the states within their environmental literacy plans are using this as their framework or have used it as their framework and then adapted and sort of moved on to make it more applicable for their particular state as they've been developing their environmental literacy plans. And then with the Green Ribbon Schools Award Program, a lot of the states were referencing this in terms of the third pillar of resources that were available as schools were developing their Green Schools Program. One of the other things that I just wanted to mention that when we started this, there were all those, you know, 11, 12 different sets of national standards. And then each of the states got to go out and do and develop their own. And they're all, so then it was sort of the, well, how do we connect to all these different sets of state standards? Well, now I'm sure you're all aware of that there are the Common Core standards for English language arts and for mathematics, and 45 of the states have developed them. The next generation science standards are supposedly coming out in early 13, we think. And there's an effort being developed for national social studies standards, or next generation equivalent. I'm not sure they come up with a title for it. The folks in Kentucky, very, very nice folks in Kentucky, have actually done a crosswalk, a matrix, between the Common Core standards for English language arts and mathematics and the guidelines. And we have that posted up online. I don't expect you to be able to read that, but just to know that we're continuing to try to do that sort of connection between this framework and the things that teachers are accountable for and what they're going to have to use in their curriculum and development. And then Scott Carley, who's with the College of Exploration, sort of did this on his own. I love him. But anyway, he was looking at the next generation science standards and trying to map how all of the various literacy efforts that were out there. So he calls it the geoscience literacy framework. So that was the ocean and the climate and energy literacy. And the various efforts that are out there, the national science education standards, how they feed into the draft, at least, of what we just had for the next generation science standards. And so one of the things that he was trying to map out and is continuing to work on is sort of how did the guidelines feed into the next generation science standards. And that's something that, of course, we're very excited about, is how that meshes and actually finding a lot of compatibility or areas of support for it. That's our website. And it's eelinked.net, and just an N and then guidelines. And you can find all sorts of stuff up there. We have all of our documents are available up there online in PDF form, so if you want them or want to share them with anyone, they're up there, as well as things like those crosswalks and all those sorts of things are available. I mentioned that we're developing a sixth set of guidelines focusing on community environmental education, and Akima Price and I are working on this, and that's her email address will be holding a little forum at NAAE to sort of to talk about the very first draft of these. And a blatant ad to the conference in October. Today's the last day of early bird registration. So get on your computer if you haven't already registered. So that's what I have.
All right, thank you very much, Cora. Why don't you stay up there now? Does anybody have any questions for Bora at this time?
Yes. Bora, it seems that the guidelines stop short of saying that an environmentally literate student would take action. Is that a purposeful
decision? Actually, I think we've always envisioned it that if you go through the process, so if you go through that issue analysis and sort of thinking about what the action strategies might be, and we have some stuff in there about evaluating your actions. So there is a notion that you're going to make a decision and you're going to act on it. Your decision might be, I'm not the right person. Or it needs to be done in a different way, or it needs to be with a particular group of people. So no, I think we've always sort of assumed that if you actually took people through the whole process, that they're going to make a conscious decision to either do something or choose that no, there isn't an appropriate action. So yeah. I mean, I'm a firm believer that this is my analogy that I always like to use, is that I don't know how many of you have ever, or remember even back to when you were learning how to drive a car, or if you've had the horrific experience of trying to teach somebody how to drive a car, is that you would never think to run a child through or a teenager through, this is the engine. And this is how an internal combustion engine works. And here are the spark plugs, and here's the and here's this, and the gas pedal, and here are the brakes, and this is how brakes work. And then say, now that you understand that, and you maybe passed a little test on the parts of the engine, here are the keys, go off and drive. So to me, what is really essential is that anyone, students, teachers, people, are able to practice the skills. That you need that skill development and you need practice. You need to be able to apply it. And if you don't apply it, then it's just this academic stuff out there. And it would be like putting a 16-year-old behind a car with just knowing that, oh, there's gasoline and there's spark plugs, and you know, if I push here, it goes faster. But not knowing how it feels to steer a car and stop a car and all of those things. So to me, that application is an essential part. And hopefully, you know, if you're starting this, I mean, these are benchmarked 4th grade, 8th grade, 12th grade, and I have this argument with people all the time, is that if you start with little stuff that is meaningful to the little kids and about their real world, you can go through this. You can start developing these skills at that younger age. And they can follow through with stuff that is appropriate for their age.
So I think we heard a lot of things that are going to be really applicable for our individual working groups. We do need to move it along, and what we're going to do right now, we need to take a quick 5-minute break. I think we want to make sure we can get the webinar up and running. Whether we can do that in 5 minutes or not, I don't know. But let's take 5 minutes, then we can come back in.
And what we'll do is, we've got the books out here. We'll just take them out of the boxes, and anybody who wants copies, take them with you. I'm not taking them.
No, I'm not sure. I don't know if you can do it in 5 minutes, but I am voice recording it. So I had to cancel it, but I restarted and remade a new webinar, and I have a draft email to go out to the participants. The only thing, the mic. it's not working, but what I'm hoping I can do is actually,
we can restart that.
We can't, but no, I tried to do that and it didn't work. So
friends with today, I start with Larry and Maggie have your wife to go in.
Okay, so I wonder if you could actually be here. Okay, I'm hoping.
Yeah, I'm going with her.
I'm hoping that I can send it out to participants, and then I'm hoping that maybe we can get the sound from this computer and then get the presenter. So that's
with all of humanity,
that's the thing that I think to do at this point.
Lines of people, because everybody knows what, like, well, not everybody, but the arts people, people clearly knew what we needed. We just we configured their whole, like, center plan. Right down there's this giant bin with, like, highlighters and markers and pencils and crayons, and I'm like, oh, wow, I'm in the elementary school. And there's, like, the high school people had, like, calculators.
I really don't think it's happening. It's okay. How you doing?
I just got an email from Sarah.
It's not that shrill.
Yeah, I might run it out right at the
like a difference.
Right, so did they pay you his time?
And what am I saying? So was he excited this morning?
No big deal now. And there's so much more adaptable. You see, I think as parents, we
Thursday, I'm like, we were doing the drill. We're right out the door at 8:10, and we did it. Everything will be done by 8:10. Lunch packed.
Like, work. We did it. Practice the drill. You think it's gonna work? We're probably gonna have to start back up again.
Unfortunately, okay. No. I'm really, really sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's just going to take me a little bit longer, I think. I think I would be able to do it in 5 minutes. I'm so sorry.
Is there a way to put a more detailed note on the canceled thing?
Unfortunately, I can't go back into it at all. I can try to figure that out later, but I don't think I can get into that. Know how to troubleshoot the problem at the moment.
Yeah.
Now it's just
it's so fun though.
started school today.
Okay. Do you have a lot?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think it's just.
I got
just,
tired just thinking of more.
Now I can't find the one that I set up.
I had to do that once. There was a workshop, and then everyone else was
to lunch. Right now we're going to have Dr. Mark Stern from Virginia Tech. Currently Mark is an associate professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Conservation at Virginia Tech. His work is focused on evaluation of environmental outreach, management effectiveness of conservation initiatives, and public response to natural resource management. He's been published in the Journal of Environmental Education, Journal of Environmental Management, just to name a few. And I know Mark is going to be hustling back to Blacksburg tonight, right, after this. So thanks so much for coming. After a quick Q&A with him, we're going to have Dr. Michelle Zint from the University of Michigan, she is the associate professor at, and Michelle, I think we've got associate professor at the School of Education, the School of Natural Resources and the Environment, and the College of Literature, Science, and Arts. That's a lot of associate professor. She's been a key figure in environmental education and evaluation, and among her many works was one of the first evaluation of the meaningful water educational experience along with Mia Kramer. She's also led the development of MIRA, my environmental education evaluation resource, which some of you are probably familiar with. It's a website that provides environmental educators with resources to help conduct and improve evaluations of their programs. So, Mark and Michela, I will turn it over to you.
All right. Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Since it's such a great group of people, I'm going to do you all a favor, especially those at the students table, those who have those sheets right there with the best practices. Just all of them are recommended. They're all flip to the back and look for new stuff.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking about some recent research that I've conducted with a colleague, Bob Powell at Clemson, that we've done for the National Park Service. They aimed us with the problem very similar to the one we're discussing here. We can't go out and survey visitors and students in our curriculum-based programs all the time. It's way too expensive. There's office and management budget. There's no way to do it. Can we track something else? So same exact ideas here. Can we identify the best practices and just track those? So that's where we started. So the big question is, what actually leads to the outcome that the Park Service is interested in? Those outcomes are an enhanced visitor experience, and that is both, you know, visitor enjoyment, but it's also connection to the resource, appreciation, and stewardship, which encompasses both attitudes and actions within the Park Service. So we started out by conducting a literature review, as you might expect, and you know, we knew right where to go for consensus-based best practices in environmental education. Thank you, Bora. Straight to the NAAA guidelines, and there's a lot of other guidelines out there. We looked at Trudy's work as well. With Harry Hunderford and others on the IEIA model. There's great stuff out there on theory as to what's supposed to work in environmental education. So we weren't too perplexed there. We were also looking at interpretive programs, though. So what I'm going to stress here is what environmental ed might learn from interpretation. Okay. So we started with best practices in interpretation as well. What's interesting about these two fields is environmental ed, if you think of the roots of these fields, environmental ed comes out of formal education. And then, you know, social psychology gets added, communications, other things. Interpretation comes basically from the performing arts. You think of the roots. Freeman Tilden, his father was a playwright, he was a journalist, he went to national parks, wrote this nice book in 1957 that gave us these principles that says good environmental communication or interpretation relates to the lives of the visitor, tells a holistic story. It's not knowledge imparting, right? It's revelation based on knowledge. We provoke the visitor to think something, feel something, do something, reflect on something. So the definition is that interpretation is the art of revealing deeper meaning of natural objects, processes, etc. So it's very overlapping with environmental ed, but it comes from a different place. There's also some other great authors like Sam Ham, some of you I'm sure know Sam Ham, who gives us good lessons about how to organize a good interpretive talk. But it should be a good introduction, it should be entertaining, it should be relevant to the audience, it needs to be thematic. So we took all these best practices, and we have best practice in environmental education, we identified 20, 25 things that we definitely hang our hat on, we identified a whole bunch more for interpretation, and we wanted to look for empirical evidence that supports these best practices. Has anyone done studies that actually prove, or well, you never quite prove anything, but rejects no hypotheses in the other direction, that these things actually work, right? So we started again with the literature, and we did a literature review in each field. And we were looking for empirical studies that actually measured an outcome of an environmental ed program or an interpretive program. And what we wanted to do was read the program descriptions. All right, what's there? All right, do we see any general patterns in the literature in terms of things that are present in the program? Do they tend to lead to better outcomes? So I'm going to start with the environmental education empirical literature review. So the way we chose these articles, there had to be a program, and it had to be adequately described such that we could identify whether certain practices were present. Now, we couldn't verify whether certain practices were absent, because they might have been there, they weren't described by the author, right? So we found 83 articles. We went back to 1999, the turn of the century. That's great. There was an interesting lit review just before that date. And the way society changes so quickly, we felt, oh, that's a reasonable look back, right? 12 years, we found 83 articles that met our criteria, and they evaluated 106 programs. So the first thing you'll notice here, right here are the outcomes we were looking for. And you notice words like sensitivity aren't here. That's because different authors think of sensitivity differently. Sometimes it's knowledge, sometimes it's awareness, sometimes it's attitudes. So we broke it up when we saw things like that. Wow. Null results are not commonly reported in the literature. So that either means that all environmental education is good, or that null results just aren't politically, you know, supported, and they're reported in the literature. So we didn't get a whole lot of variability in whether they're positive findings or not. You see knowledge is the most commonly measured, followed by attitudes. So what we did is we carried on anyway. We knew that this would probably be the case, but we still wanted to see whether there was some evidence. We took all of these. I, for this analysis I'm about to show, the next table, I knocked out satisfaction and enjoyment. So you have handouts of these around your table because the table's going to be small. What you're looking at here is if it measured any one of those six first outcomes, it's in here, all right? So here's the program characteristics. Observed is underneath that little green thing. How many times do we observe that program characteristic and a measured outcome? Any one of them. If it's positive, it means every outcome that was measured of those six was positive. Mixed, at least one of them had a null finding. Null, the whole thing was null. They didn't have good findings. So what you should instantly be coming to here is, well, there's circumstantial evidence for everything we do. That's great. NAAA guidelines are working. You know, and we have these things, right? Project, the stars up here, and take this with a grain of salt, because just because it coincides, program characteristic and outcome, it's not causal necessarily. But these were the two most commonly associated with positive outcomes. When we saw that, just through chi-squared analysis, we see that those are more positive outcomes. Traditional programs, we actually got four of those that were just lecture. There were only four of them. They're generally used as control groups. So you get a general sense here, but it still doesn't give us any golden nugget or silver bullet that says, yay, we actually have strong evidence for this. So we want to take a next step, and we said, well, let's reread these articles. We've reread them tons of times. But let's reread them and focus on the discussion section and see what authors are claiming, why a program worked or didn't work. What do the authors actually say? They observe these things. They studied them. They know a lot about them. So what you're looking at here is these are the things authors claimed explain success or failure of a program. Okay, they said, well, it was successful because it was experiential or because it was issue-based on down the line. Lots of claims. Okay, how many has some level of empirical support? And what I mean by empirical support, we were lenient here. It's actually lower if you want to use a strong term. But it was basically there was some evidence that they were basing it on where they could isolate a factor. So in a few cases, there actually was a control group. Like dosage is a great example. There are actually studies where there would be an event, and this really supports the MeWe concept, where there was a pre-experience activity and a post-experience activity, and then another one where they didn't do that, and it made a difference. Right? In fact, 12 of these dosage ones had to do with prep and reflection and an activity, and two of them had empirical support. Empirical support, though, also could mean qualitative data. So there's a group of folks in Australia, Jan Packer, something you probably know, Ray Ballantyne, who did some really neat comparative studies. And they would ask students, they did tons of interviews with students, and they'd be like, well, what about the program got you to that attitude or that feeling or that action? So they actually had some data. Not statistical data, but qualitative data. We counted that as empirical support, too. If the students were saying, well, the whole reason was because I got to touch the fish, you know, whatever it might have been. So I'm just going to highlight a couple of these things that I think are pretty powerful here. Doses I already talked about. Empowerment, we've been hearing a lot about that already. This isn't often directly built into a program, but authors often see it. It's like, wow, this worked because of something the students felt something at the end. That kind of goes hand in hand with this affective element explicitly incorporated. What's interesting about the affect, that's just emotional connection, explicitly built into a program. Like, a lot of times that's with like cute and fuzzy bunnies or some sort of animal connection or even art or poetry. They don't set out to measure that ever. We never saw that explicitly measured, but we saw it reflected on a lot. The author's like, wow, it had that. That's what made the difference in this program. Other ones that I want to highlight here. Style or identity of presenter or educator. You're going to hear a lot more about this when I talk about interpretation. This is really interesting. Again, it's never set out to, we never saw it measured in environmental education. But what is it about the educator themselves? Do they exude passion and charisma and knowledge, anything like that? Not measured. But authors often are at the end saying, wow, that's what made the difference. It was the person. Okay? And these two are qualitative data backing that up. Some other kind of cool stuff in here. Mismatch between outcomes and program design. This is my favorite thing that my friend Sam Hamm calls poof theory. You know, that we've all drank this Kool-Aid that if we teach kids about butterflies and chrysalises, they're going to go and recycle and get their parents to buy a Prius. And it just doesn't happen. You have to base the program on the outcomes that you want to get, right? So this was noted by eight authors that, like, well, we measured behavior, but the program had nothing to do with that, so we didn't expect it anyway, right? School teacher involvement. A lot of these had to do with field trips or a residential experience. When the school teacher who visited with the kids was actively engaged in the program on site in teaching, alongside, you know, the interpreter or the camp counselor, it worked out better for the students. One had, this is a study of mine actually, had empirical evidence to back that up. And there's a lot to that with role model theory and thinking about that, why that is the case. These ones I've just turned pink, I'm just pointing them out because I know Trudy's going to talk about IEIA. I have a colleague who always ends up going, These are explicitly IEEIA stuff. And you could argue that experiential is too, but you could have one without the other. It's very supported. That type of an approach is very supported circumstantially. Okay, so I'll just tell you right now, we did a very similar review for interpretive studies, and the literature was a bit weaker. Almost all these studies are just one-off of a single program, right? And at the end, the authors are saying, yes, the program worked, hooray, but there's very little reflection on why it worked and why it didn't. There may be speculation, but there's very little empirical research as to why. Well, we recognize that, and we actually convinced the Park Service to fund a study so that we can empirically isolate what we have. So before I jump to that, I'm just going to give you the conclusions of the E-Lit review, and then I'll go into that empirical study, where I actually did a study to isolate the best practices. Okay, so we've already mentioned, yes, circumstantial evidence is there for all best practices, particularly these. Authors and our just pairing exercise shows that these things really come out very powerful. I mean, it would be hard to argue against these things in environmental education. There was also strong speculation for place-based outdoors effective elements. Place-based not just being outside, but that the education is actually about the place. In this case, that's how we define it. And the styles and qualities of educators. But again, these two things, they're always sort of post hoc musings of the author. And again, I've already mentioned all these caveats, but there's no causation here. It's just sort of pairing and speculation is what we got. So no one's done that study yet. If you'd like to fund it, I'd be happy to do it. To actually isolate factors, too. Okay, so that's what we actually did with this empirical study in the National Parks. We trained up a team of four graduate students to view things similarly as best we could. We sent them to 24 park units, very variable, ranging from Yosemite to Forest Deer to Wind Cave. They were all over the country. They went to nearly 400 interpretive programs, and at those programs, they had an auditing sheet with about 70 characteristics they were tracking of the program. Exactly what did that interpreter do? What were the components of the program? So these programs were kids and adults. Immediately following the program, we had all the independent variables, right? All the program characteristics. We did visitor surveys, nearly 4,000 of those. And we could actually compare across programs the outcomes. And our hope was we could actually isolate the impacts of the program characteristics on those outcomes. It was pretty ambitious to do, and we were worried about it from the very get-go. Here are the outcomes we looked at. Satisfaction was one. These came out of factor analysis, so they're indexes. Basically, we want to know whether the program influenced the meaningfulness of the visit, their knowledge and appreciation for the park and resources, so you can think of the corollary as attitudes. And this one could be behavioral intentions. Our main concern is, you know, if you're standing at the base of Half Dome looking up at it, we call it the halo effect. It's like, unless the ranger pukes on you, you probably had a good experience, right? So we're worried about getting variability in these things. That's a real challenge, is designing the dependent variables so that there's enough movement. And what we found was we got enough variability, but not as much as we wanted. If you were to convert these into like a 1 to 10 scale, the variability was between 6 and 10. not 1 to 10. So it was a very happy finding from the Park Service. Said, hey, all of our programs are at least pretty good. But what it means for us in this case is that we were able to isolate the characteristics that make the difference between a good and great program, not between a great and bad program. Mm-hmm. It was that variability we were able to isolate. So what do we find? Okay. Small, that's why I give you handouts. The stuff in the left is the strongest stuff correlated with outcomes. Right? They are all correlated with the same outcomes. First one, first two, these are characteristics of the interpreter's style. Okay, so we had these measures and we had to pilot test this 100 times to get consistent in this, but comfort. Do they feel do they look comfortable in their own shoes? Eloquence and their apparent knowledge of the subject. That we call confidence. Authentic emotion and charisma has to do with passion and sincerity. Authentic emotion. You know, a story of a ranger at a war memorial kind of pausing and putting their hand on the monument when they're talking about something. And doing it in a real way rather than you can imagine doing that in a really cheesy way too, right? You can tell the difference between that. So a lot of it had to do with that interpreter themselves. Appropriateness for the audience often to do with the age level, whether they're hitting at the right level. Here's where we get more into Tilden's principles and Sam Ham's stuff, organization. And the real key with these things are, first, a holistic story, a complete story, with an introduction, a plot, characters, and an end. Far more effective than just factual information. Or tidbits of really interesting and even entertaining things, not as effective as a story. Connection. So this is a common term in interpretation, links to intangibles and universal concepts. To demonstrate that, I can say this is a tangible thing, right? The clicker I'm holding. The intangible is the story behind it. And I could tell a million stories about this, what it allows me to do. I can play with a cat with it. I can tell you about the materials that go into it. To link it to a universal concept, I have to bring sort of the moral of the story out, right? So if I'm talking about materials, this would be, well, think of, you know, the 17 different countries that came together to produce this and what that means to you, right? That's the idea of going to those three levels. But really this has to do, again, with provocation. This is not about knowledge. This is about connecting it to something deeper within the visitor, making it relevant to the visitor's life. Okay, did they explicitly build that in? Consistency was very interesting. This was whether the tone and quality was consistent throughout the whole program. So oftentimes, interpreters will use this as a mechanism. They'll like start really somber. They get really funny and then like get somber again. That was not good for visitor outcomes, typically. I mean, there's exceptions to all this stuff. But in general, that consistent tone was a very powerful thing. And these are a little more self-explanatory. I'm going to jump right down to here. We asked interpreters right before their programs, so what are you going for here? And we had a list of 9 outcomes. They had somewhere like, I want to enhance appreciation of the resource. I want to impart knowledge. That was the major intended outcome. If that's what the ranger was going for, visitor outcomes were worse. Okay? If that was the main thing. So I've been to some trainings. Is our Park Service person still here? Should we? I've been to trainings in the Park Service where they're training people that, well, you should be able to impart knowledge. And I was like, no. It's about this other stuff, and that's what makes it a powerful experience. We know that intuitively. Here's some empirical data you can use to back it up. And we also had occasional bad assumptions about an audience. And this was really common in the Park Service, and it may be in some of our settings, where we assume prior knowledge. Just because somebody comes to a Civil War park doesn't mean they know anything about the Civil War. And oftentimes interpreters will start with illusions that people just couldn't understand. So that's a lot of best practices. What translates into environmental education? Well, I think there's a few really interesting things here, to me anyway, that do. The role of the individual educator is largely missing from our field. If you know of it, send it to me. I haven't really seen that. I've looked. It's not really there. The affective domain, emotional connections, we all know about that in theory, but we don't see much study about that. So we don't have a lot of empirical evidence, although all these authors are after the program, and probably after your programs, those of you who are educators, you know that if there was that emotional thing that happened, that did it, right? And lastly, probably the biggest lesson from interpretation that can translate nicely into environmental education is this idea of a holistic story. We've seen programs, we've also done evaluations of curriculum-based programs in the National Park Service and seen, well, it was a great program, it was a science project. They could have done it in the lab, but they went to the national park and did it. And we don't see these stellar outcomes in those types of programs. They're fine. They're great. You know, they get their knowledge gain. It was nice for them to get out of the classroom. But if you want to get to the deeper stewardship attitudes and behaviors, that is probably not the most powerful way to do it. Having that holistic thing that somebody can see themselves in, a story they can, it's sort of like the foreground of a really good painting. I mean, you always feel like you can step in, right? If students can't step into that, it doesn't quite hit it. And that's what we saw in our interpretation study as well. All right, last slide. So what ideas about best practices? First off, all the stuff in the NAAA guidelines, they're supported by what we've seen. And that's not surprising at all from the 15 years of work you've done. It makes a lot of sense. They are on the right track. There's a handful of additional things that we think we've uncovered and maybe can add. So not surprising at all, longer experience, dosage. Yep. More is better, if it's good, of course. But this next one, the holistic experience, having that complete picture seems to, at least from our study, really made a difference. Relevant real-world context. So these are all buzzwords that you saw earlier today. So NIWIs are absolutely on the right track, in my opinion. Explicitly incorporate an affective component into something like IEEIA, where students get to sort of reflect personally, not just on the action that's out there, but on their role with it and that empowerment piece. Seems to be really supported by all these authors as well. Explicit reflection, so we have that in the movies as well. Aligning program design with goals, and I think Michelle is going to go here a little bit. Talking about if you want a behavioral outcome, there is outstanding social-psychological behavioral theories you can use to get closer to behavioral outcomes. And it's amazing how many of us kind of drank the Kool-Aid about like the butterfly teaching, we didn't tell these wonderful things. Really, if you have certain goals, you start with those, and the logic modeling exercises can really help you get to them. And lastly, the role of the educator, right? Their identity, their style, and particularly their sincerity. So I'm really psyched about these two teacher tables and the professional development. I really think if we use these same sort of techniques that we're talking about in environmental education on environmental educators, that they're probably going to work there too, right? If you want to get people excited and empowered about doing this, it's all the same stuff that should work. So in a way, maybe this is the place we need to hit it now. It seems like we're starting to hit it really well with students. There and getting educators kind of excited about the stuff for the next piece. Right, so that's what I was going to say there. getting teachers committed to this idea. And we all know, I mean, the classic example, I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and of course, if those of you are parents, you're paranoid about which teacher they're going to get, right? They all teach the same curriculum. It's not the curriculum. We're good at that now. I really think we're getting that. It's that teacher. Right? So there's something there that I don't think we're quite getting. Thanks.
Mark and Michelle insisted that we open the floor quickly for any questions for Mark. I don't want to lose it.
No, don't blame Mark. I insisted.
No, I think it's a great idea. I heard a lot of wonderful things in that presentation. So questions for Mark now.
Well, I find the presentation was great, and what I find interesting, which I'm sure was exactly mine, but you didn't come out and say, is really it's also the dichotomy between formal and informal learning, between free choice learning and in-school learning, and bringing in some of those best practices of informal, but also in terms of the dosage, linking what happens in schools and out of schools, and I wonder if you could comment on that for me.
Yeah. I can agree with what you just said. Yeah, I mean, that's probably a question for somebody who knows more about the formal realm than me. But yeah, I really think that there's a role to bring this stuff in, and there's got to be a way politically to do it. I mean, that's the trick, right? If you say it's about the teacher and about these emotional components, that's a tougher sell. So packaging it in an appropriate way that makes sense to everybody is going to be harder, at least to talk about it.
Quick question on the, when you said, you know, general finding was that the Park Service programs were generally good to great, and there wasn't a whole lot of examples of bad. Would it be a safe assumption to say that the fact that the programs happened at those locations as opposed to in a room on a PowerPoint? Perhaps as an explanation for the good grade?
I would say, and that's what I was thinking, so we actually had a measure for the impressiveness of the resource, right? So we controlled for, yeah, standing at the base of Half Dome versus being in the visitor center in front of a PowerPoint screen. It actually did not make a difference where it was. It didn't. And it shocked me. I looked at it and I tried to make new scales out of variables and asked him. And it didn't. It really didn't. It was these other pieces that really drove it. And the types of parks we were in were so widely variable in terms of what you're looking at.
The good to great was the rating of the observers or the rating of the people who were there?
Of the visitors. So our ratings,
so they were going
the whole
there.
There were programs we thought were terrible, right. Yet visitors still liked them.
I mean, the visitors were choosing to go to these places. Yes. So that, that there's like a psychological phenomenon that if you expect something to be good, then you're not going to, like, I spent all this time coming here, I'm not going to say it was terrible.
Yeah, there's actually explicit theory related to the social expectations.
Right.
That inflate stuff. So we're really happy that we had some variability.
Yeah.
So one of the things you mentioned early on was the when teachers teach alongside the non-formal educators or in a field-based program, that showed a positive result in the students, afterwards. But what do you mean by teaching alongside? Is that
all right? The example I'm most familiar with is the study we did at Tremont, which is in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, so residential center, and teachers have a choice when they come there to either sit back and just kind of observe and let the instructors do everything, or they can do like a crash course training and they kind of do parts of the programs along with the on-site instructors. We saw a few examples of that in the literature. And so that's what we mean. It's not necessarily, it's not fleshed out enough to have the guidelines for how to do that, but the fact that the teacher's engaged and clearly validating this and being part of it seem to make a difference.
Corrine, you had a question with Corrine.
It's not so much a question as it is a comment, and maybe it starts with a question. Are you familiar with the book, The Experience Economy, by Joseph Pine and James Gilmore? Okay, I highly recommend that you read it. A lot of what you're looking for in terms of experience is in this book. There's another book subsequently that has recently been released about the transformation economy, and it's about how people's experiences are driving our economy. So it's really well done, and it may lead you to some other information that will help answer some of the questions, particularly about individual involvement in presentations. So, anyway.
Great. Yeah. Jennifer.
Yeah, I'm curious about how the Park Service has received this information in terms of how it translates into training. I mean, it sounds like three part inspiration, one part knowledge. How much of this do you feel is trainable, teachable, inspirable?
Well, I think when we started, they wanted a monitoring system. So they wanted to create new standards that they can hold people accountable for, which we fought tooth and nail all the way because we feel it should be more about adaptive management, iterative improvement. So we've managed to convince them that this shouldn't be about monitoring, and they probably couldn't do it anyway, because these are hard things to monitor unless you have one traveling team, monitoring this. There's a self-reporting on this. The training, we're working with them right now to put this directly into their training. And sort of the unspoken kind of piece behind this has to do with organizational culture. If you think about interpreters and how they feel going into the program. We asked them that. How excited are you to give this program right now here? That was very predictive of outcomes, whether they felt good. So that empowerment of teachers, that empowerment of educators and interpreters is huge. And I really think that that's a piece of the professional development piece, is giving the freedom and the confidence. And that same empowerment variable we want our students to have, that the educators, is going to just translate right down. I mean, it may be this. And this is subjective me speaking, not any firm data. I think that's probably the number one thing I'd be working on right now, is how do you get people to feel passion, the teachers. Because I think we all know intuitively that makes a difference.
Take one more now.
Yeah, you had in your outcomes, you're talking about behavior change. Did you get any information on that?
Yeah, so our challenge with this is that you can imagine the disparate programs we're looking at. I was like, talk about the Liberty Bell, and I talk about, poop in the backcountry of Yosemite. Right? our measures were really broad. So we actually did try to do a pre-post. We couldn't get enough sample size on the pre-experience to use it. So instead we did retrospective surveys. So we asked, to what extent has this program changed the way you will behave in this park, the way you will behave when you go home? Those were the two questions that we could use. It was a Likert type scale, 1 to 5. So we don't have detail. We do have a lot of write-ins saying, I already, you know, behaved perfectly, so we have you know, that's the self-selection issue.
Thanks, Mark. And any more questions, hit up over lunch.
Okay, and I brought, there's like 10 copies, because it's a big, thick report, of this interpretive study report that are sitting up here. If anyone wants to grab them, I'll bring them home. So.
Can we get a digital copy from you?
Kevin's going to put it on the website.
Yep. We've got the Stack website where all these documents are going to be going.
And all the caveats and weaknesses of the study are better described in the report.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Michaela.
Since MeWe's focused so much on watersheds, and you're all very familiar with the Chesapeake Bay watershed, I thought I'd introduce you to our watershed, the Huron River watershed that the University of Michigan is in. And in fact, the Huron River runs right through, let's see, Ann Arbor. That's us right here. So I thought you might enjoy learning about that briefly. I'll give you a very brief introduction to BWET and MeWe's. It'll be a little bit repetitive in terms of what Shannon said, but we all know repetition is important, so I figured we'll work on that front. I'll talk to you about a literature review I did of watershed education research and related research to try to link to the MeWe practices and see what the research actually says about them. And then I'll talk to you about an evaluation that Anita Kramer and Jeff Kerwin did in 2007 that actually evaluated MeWe's in the Chesapeake Bay region, and to tell you a little bit about what all that means in terms of MeWe practices. Time permitting, and I think it's totally unrealistic, but I'm always hopeful, I'll talk about an evaluation that Anita and I are currently working on for the National BWET program, and I'll also briefly mention a watershed outreach guide that some students of mine prepared for the Chesapeake Bay Trust that I thought you might be interested in. So MeWe's are now implemented not only in the Chesapeake Bay region, but actually across the country. It's a national program that NOAA supports. The mission is to promote environmental literacy, but as part of that mission is also behavior change, the behavior change goal. So you can see it's not just in the Chesapeake, but also in 6 other regions in the country. And the idea is they all support MeWe's, but the implementation is supposed to be targeted to meet local needs. And the other idea that I think has not been mentioned is that it's supposed to build on NOAA resources. I don't know why it automatically changes things on me. So those are MeWe's. Brief introduction. Why is this not?
Is the video not working?
No, it's not supposed to be a video. It's just supposed to be going forward.
Okay, just the arrow. Let me take a look.
Okay. I will stand here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where's the up and down key? Right here. Mm. Which ones are you using? Okay. Thank you.
So I have to stand right in front of
you.
You're fine.
I like control. As a matter of fact, we all do, but okay. Sorry to tell you this. Okay. So, student, minimum MeWe's. As has already been mentioned, the idea of a minimum MeWe, it has 3 phases. It has a preparation phase, action phase, and reflection phase. The idea is the preparation, there's some kind of a question that is being set up, a problem or an issue. Action, there's supposed to be a minimum of a 2-door outdoor experience or a multi-day experience, and there's supposed to be some action related to either environmental study or change. And when I'm talking about these descriptions right now, these are not about the MeWe's here locally in the Chesapeake Bay region. This is sort of across the board nationally. So it's a little bit different, what I'm going to emphasize. There is supposed to be a reflection component that includes analysis, assessment, and communication. They're supposed to be aligned with standards. They're supposed to employ NOAA sciences, data, personnel, sometimes also sanctuaries. And again, a little bit repetitive, hands-on, focused on question, issue, projects, etc. The teacher professional development minimum is supposed to be a 3-day professional development that includes outdoors. There's supposed to be adequate reflection, follow-up, and support, and there's supposed to be incentives. So that's a brief introduction to the quote-unquote sort of minimum best practices. And so what I'll now do is, why does it do that? Talk to you about the research and what the research says as related to this, and I'll summarize it up for you at the end. So first, let me begin by saying, is there a need for watershed education? I don't suppose in a room like this I need to stress that, but there is. There's been only a few national studies, and here's one of the more recent ones, which you can actually tell is a little bit outdated. And that suggests that adults and children, there's a large number of adults and children that don't know what a watershed is.
I feel like it's on an automatic setting embedded in the PowerPoint.
Okay.
So I apologize.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'll try to do this again. And they don't, you know, they equate watersheds and wetlands. They don't know where their water drains. They don't know non-point source pollution, what that means, and they are not aware of the threats of land use, or at least a significant portion is not aware. So there's clearly a need for watershed education. This is 2001, but even more recent studies and smaller scales also support this. So the literature shows that there are a number of potential benefits to watershed education, such as improved understanding of watersheds, enhanced environmental attitudes and behaviors, increased advocacy for the environment, strengthened civic responsibility, and for teachers, an improved understanding of watersheds. So a lot of the kinds of benefits that we're all hoping for, the literature supports. Now the question is, what practices lead to those benefits, right? And so here's a list of some of those practices. Long-term, and I have it in parentheses because it sort of depends, not always. Long-term, place-based, hands-on science inquiry. There's a number of programs that provide evidence that you can link to those practices. Outdoor learning experiences. Demonstrations are models that make invisible parts of watershed systems visible, i.e. there's a lot of abstract concepts within watersheds, and so if you can make those more concrete, that helps. The use of instructional technologies such as web-based GIS maps, Google Earth, and service learning. So those kinds of practices have been linked to these kinds of outcomes.
Front or back? Back?
Back forward. Didn't have any problems with it at home. Sorry about that. I get more time. Right?
I need more time with that slide.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot. So here, so let me talk about one of the elements that, if you go back here, science inquiry is important, outdoor learning is important, so I'm going to focus in a little bit more on those in particular. I really would like to. Let me tell you already, at least I know my next slide is coming.
There it is.
I'm proud of myself. So this one is about science inquiry, and so the question is, you know, is science inquiry actually more effective in fostering student understanding of science than more passive techniques? That's the question. And there's been a review by Minner et al. That reviewed 138 studies, because I think the important thing that often happens is we focus on single studies, but that's extremely limiting. You really want to look across the board. So here's a lit review of 138 studies, and very interestingly, these authors did not find, this is their language, overwhelmingly positive evidence that science inquiry per se, as a process, was more effective necessarily than passive techniques. However, they also found a clear and consistent trend that when students are engaged in thinking about and drawing conclusions from data, then those practices tend to be more effective than more passive techniques. The other thing that I thought was really interesting from this review, this of so many studies, is that students didn't necessarily need to actively be involved in collecting the data in order to see that. They just needed to be able to think about it and draw conclusions about data. They didn't actually have to collect it in order for them to have these positive learning outcomes, which I thought was interesting. So from a NOAA perspective, it means that if NOAA has data and students get to analyze that data, think about that data,
draw conclusions from the data, that's actually quite effective. They don't actually have to go out in the field and collect their very own data. Okay. Outdoor field work, another review, in this case of 150 studies, trying to understand the benefits of outdoor education and what practices lead to those particular benefits. And so in that particular review, they found benefits of outdoor work, outdoor field work specifically, leading to higher order learning, so that's the cognitive side, to improved attitudes, and also improved interpersonal and social outcomes. So the way that kids interacted with one each other was improved in a number of studies as a result of being engaged in outdoor field work. There was far less evidence that outdoor field work led to behavioral outcomes. Out of those 150 studies, there were only two studies that suggested that, but just like Mark indicated, you know, studies are not reported if they don't have those particular outcomes, so can't be sure. But the majority of the studies didn't really look at that. But anyways, nonetheless, still only two seem to suggest that. So the evidence on outdoor fieldwork leading to behavioral outcomes is extremely limited. And so what practices, again, led to those outcomes? The length of the program, the longer, the more sustained, just like we heard. Mark had the same finding. The preparatory work and the characteristics of that preparation. So were the students introduced to the concepts that they were going to learn about and the skills? Were they introduced to the setting? What was the setting going to be like? And the processes, what they were going to be doing in that setting. The experience itself, the nature of the experience itself also mattered, and there are a number of characteristics such as the amount of structure, and so not too much, not too little. The opportunities that were there for them to directly interact with the environment. Mark had that example of a child maybe interacting with an animal being a stronger experience, more positive experience. The role modeling by the educators, very consistent with what Mark said as well. And whether or not there was choice in the activities. We know that in terms of facilitating learning, it's good to give learners some choice. And then the last but not least, was their work in the end linking the outdoor experiences with what the kids were learning in the classroom. So all of those practices in this synthesis of 150 studies then led to those particular benefits. So next let me move to another review that I did thanks to the wonderful help of a number of my students. And this particular study focuses on 10 behavioral outcome evaluations. So what my goal was actually, this particular chapter was about learning about program evaluation in environmental education and seeing what was going on in the field in that regard, strengths and weaknesses. But in order to narrow that down, I decided to focus on behavioral outcome evaluations in particular. So I looked in the literature going back to actually the first issue of the Journal of Environmental Education in the mid-60s. And we looked through the environmental education literature to find evaluations, not research, and I can go into what that means, but to focus in on just evaluations of environmental education programs that looked at whether or not there were behavioral outcomes. And I found, surprisingly, somewhat only 10 that really did that. The earliest one from 1979, the latest in 2009. And so we reviewed those particular evaluations, whether or not they led to behavior outcomes or not. And contrary to what Mark had indicated, but I think I totally agree with him, is usually you don't find negative findings in the literature, because all of these studies typically didn't just look at behavior outcomes, also knowledge and attitude. So they still got published. They published that there were knowledge and attitude changes, but maybe not behavior changes. So I had actually a sample that included programs that had no behavior change and some that did. And so I was able to qualitatively look at, you know, what were the characteristics of the programs that had no changes and the characteristics of programs that did have changes. And so this is sort of on average. It's not always true, but in general. And so the question for you, this is the one interactive component I could think of, is do you think option one or option two, i.e., what are the characteristics of programs that result in behavior change?
Two.
Yeah, this informed audience, what other choice would you have picked? That's right. So the programs that had no behavior change outcomes didn't have behavioral objectives to begin with, okay? Just sort of like knowledge or attitudinal changes. They focused on general environmental knowledge and attitudes, not related to the behavior goals that might be there. They were passive in nature, they were top-down, and they were typically very short. Those programs that did have these behavioral outcomes had specific behavioral objectives. They were then drawing on behavior theories and models that we know are effective, such as the Hungerford and Wolf model, in getting behavioral outcomes. This is, again, like what Mark was saying, these programs that were effective were actually drawing on models that are effective, not on intuitive ideas, not those poof theories. They had experiential learning incorporated. They considered participants' needs and contexts, and they were longer in duration, typically. I'm going to tell you very briefly about one program that was one of the 10 that we looked at, which is one of mine, which I therefore understand better than some of the others. And it was actually an evaluation Anita and I did working with Don Ba, an evaluation of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation EE programs. And this one is a little bit of an exception. Like I said, this is true on average, but not always true. And so here, what you have on the left hand is you have characteristics that have been associated with changes in behavior. This comes from the Hungerford and Wolf model, which prior to that comes from the, I think, informed by the Hines study, which was, again, a study of, I don't know how many studies, where they looked at least, I think, 50, 100 studies.
128.
To identify what variables lead to behavior changes. So those are on the left-hand column. And then you see several different environmental education programs that the Chesapeake Bay Foundation offered at the time, although they offered even additional ones. A two-week field trip program, a three-day field trip program, a one-day field trip program, a restoration project that was just in its pilot phase, and and one of their curriculum materials. And what you can see is that, just for the purposes very briefly, is there is a big difference between the number of check marks. The check marks reflect significant changes in students before and after the experience on those variables. And so what you can see, and also in keeping in mind a comparison group, in contrast to a comparison group that did not have these experiences. And so just looking at it, you can see that the experiential components programs had many more check marks. And therefore have a much higher likelihood of leading to behavior change than the curriculum, which just had the one check mark in knowledge of issues. Now, in fairness, and this is where it's so important to monitor implementation, which was, again, also stressed in Mark's point, is the curriculum, as educators we all know, is the enacted curriculum, is never the intended curriculum. This particular curriculum, what we learned is most teachers only implemented like 3 lessons, not the 12 activities they were supposed to do, not the service learning they were supposed to do, not the actions that they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really a flaw of the curriculum per se. We don't know if the curriculum would have led to those changes, really, honestly, but it's the implementation. Okay, so just wanting to show you that in this case, these programs were not 1 to 2 years, but we still concluded that there was a high likelihood they might lead to some changes in behavior just because look at the number of checks and the intention to act, which we know is very closely associated with behavior change. So that's an example of one of the 10 studies that we reviewed. Let me also talk a little bit about what we know about professional development, first within the context of watershed education and then within the broader context of professional development in general. One study showed that a 2-day workshop, 2 to 3 week summer institute, followed workshops during the academic year and one during which that entire time teachers were engaged in conducting scientific investigations, did increase teachers' understanding of watershed science. There's also been an evaluation of GLOBE, which is an earth science curriculum, inquiry-based, was much more the characteristics of professional development that led to data reporting and more effective implementation had the following characteristics. They aligned with the teacher's learning goals for him or herself, as well as the learning goals for the students. They included planning time for how to implement the GLOBE activities. And because the GLOBE activities are based on, they have to follow certain protocols, it's very technical. In this case, technical support was also identified as very important. So, but those were the only studies of teacher professional development in the watershed education context that I could really find. So we also looked at professional development. And again, this is a synthesis piece. Although this one is not, I would say this is more qualitative in nature, but here are some of the characteristics that this overview suggested were very important for professional development. Again, duration, very important. One study of teachers, some self-report suggests that there is a need for a minimum of 30 hours before teachers report that they learned anything or might do something different. Professional development should emphasize content, pedagogy, that's the how to teach the content, and what we also call pedagogical content knowledge, which is knowing how to teach particular content, in what sequence and with what methods, because not all pedagogies are appropriate for all contents. It requires teachers to examine and reflect on their own practice. So again, this reflection element is important, not just with students, but also with teachers. It provides social support. Teaching, as we all know, those of us who've taught, is a very isolating experience, and social support is very important if you want teachers to change. It is closely coupled to what they're supposed to be doing in the classroom. It is structured around materials and activities that teachers can directly employ. And it situates teachers' learning and representations of practice. So, I'm sorry for the jargon. It essentially means, like, if you want teachers to do inquiry-based science, you better have them do it during the professional development. So if you want them to do MeWe's, you better have them do it, be the student in the professional development. That's what all that means. So now I want to move on to the one and only study that I'm aware of MeWe's, per se, that Anita and Jeff Curran and I were engaged in, and tell you a little bit about that, because again, it provides some insight into practices that might be appropriate, both on the student and the teacher front. In this case, we had pre-post questionnaires. You can see here we had fairly good sample sizes in terms of students who participated in the MeWe treatments, as well as the comparison groups. And then for teachers, we had post-professional development questionnaires. So what outcomes did we see? And Shannon already introduced you to those earlier. So again, those same characteristics that have been associated with changes in behaviors that you saw in the earlier slide for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, we looked at those same characteristics. And in the MeWe studies, we found that 3 out of 8 increased. And you see the effect sizes here. For those of you, a 1 is perfect. That's higher is better. And so you can see some pretty great, substantial effect sizes for knowledge of issues, knowledge of actions, and a reasonable 1 for intention to act, considering that that's a harder one to achieve. However, there were no significant changes in environmental sensitivity, which environmental sensitivity, and I hate to be talking about work that really others have done, but from my understanding, it requires a much longer time period. There need to be role models involved, maybe a bit earlier age even, so it makes sense why we wouldn't have seen it. There were also no changes in personal responsibility or individual or group efficacy. What that means is that empowerment aspect, the feeling that you can make a difference. So nonetheless, you did see those 3 changes in some very important variables, such as knowledge of actions and intention to act. If you want behavior change, they better be there. And so here were the characteristics of MeWe's that, that were associated with those. Relevance, how important that students felt what they were learning was to their lives was very important. So again, consistent with what Mark said, I believe. Hands-on, that they felt they were engaged in some hands-on experience that they collected. In this case, the self-report suggests that collecting and analyzing data was important. That they were learning outdoors, that they had time to reflect. And this is an interesting one. Just even reading and discussing the issues actually had a very positive association with all eight, and this is with all eight variables, not just the ones that we actually found significant changes with. And then participating in an action project. On to the teachers. So we looked at the teacher professional development as well, and as already Shannon said, there were changes in teacher confidence and intentions. And the practices that, let me say a little bit more. We also found out a little bit about MeWe implementation subsequent to the professional development. We learned that 93% taught about the watershed or the bay after the professional development, including the 87% who did not do so before. So that this professional development experience really worked in terms of getting the students to change their teaching. And the other thing that we found is that about one-third of the teachers taught complete MeWes, what we call complete MeWes, after the PD, which meant that they focused in on watersheds, they had an outdoor learning component, they had an issue investigation or an action project as part of it. So those are pretty cool results, but we also have to acknowledge that there was about a fourth of the teachers that after the professional development did not teach outdoors, and one half that did not conduct an issue or action project.
Okay, so quick question. Mm-hmm. Was this in the year that they received the professional development, the year after?
It was after. It's more complicated. There was a group that had participated in professional development before we were even on the horizon. And so we went back many, many years and put together a sample and contacted those teachers. And it also included 60 teachers who had participated in the professional development, and then we followed up, I don't know how much later, but I think it would have been between 3 and 6 months. Don't quote me, I have to look it up. So we did follow up with some current teachers.
Two months.
This is why I need Anita always. Because she knows this.
Yes. I'm willing to be controlled.
Yes.
The component of the administrators offering support to these teachers at all?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We need a study on that.
So let me talk about the professional development characteristics that were associated with these outcomes I just went over, okay? So here they are. Essentially, the professional developments that had these features were more likely to result in the outcomes I've just reviewed for you. And it was whether or not they talked about the benefits of MeWes in terms of academic achievement. So did they make a case that with MeWes you can probably improve the academic achievement of your students? That it can increase the awareness, knowledge, and actions of your students? And that you can meet your district and school standards. So if professional development addressed these benefits, then you are more likely to see those outcomes I just reviewed with you. They also had follow-up support as being very important. Whether or not the teachers during the professional development were conducting environmental action or researching environmental issues. Remember, going back to that, did they actually do the practices that they were supposed to eventually do? The duration, the longer the better. And did the professional development include hands-on learning, practicing of new skills, and planning for integration into the curriculum? So these outcomes that I just reviewed with you here were more likely to happen if the professional development had these characteristics. And the way we did that was sort of similar with the idea that Mark had, is we looked at the teachers, a group of teachers, that were more likely to have the changes that we had hoped after and not, and see what distinguished those two groups, and that's how we ended up with these. So what? So what does it tell us about MeWes? So if you remember, student MEWIS are supposed to have these implementation phases, and there is support for the importance of preparation for the question problem issue approach, for the fact that, you know, there should be some kind of an implementation element, the fact that outdoor experiences have lots of positive outcomes. I put a question mark by the minimum of the two outdoor experiences, because the duration, the research would suggest that the duration might be a bit short. I put a check mark by reflection and analysis. All those were supported by, if you remember, the science inquiry meta-analysis. Alignment with standards, the professional development research strongly supports. The fact that they could think about and analyze data is supported by, again, that science inquiry research. And the hands-on focus question issue project orientation is also strongly supported by that research I reviewed on environmental education programs, the ones that included that led to behavioral outcomes. So on the learning front, I think it's looking awfully good, and so I put a check mark there. On the behavior change front, I think it's a little less clear, because if you look back at what characteristics programs have, environmental ed programs have, I don't feel as confident to make that claim. Or I would not. That doesn't mean you can't. You can look at the same data and also decide. On the teacher professional development part, I put both. So right now, I think it's too hard to say. There's not enough detail. There's not enough detail flesh out to really say for sure. The good news is, okay, so there is professional development. If you think 3 days, that adds up to about 25 hours. That one study suggests 30 hours is kind of a minimum, so it's kind of close. The outdoor element, we know this, if you want teachers to teach outdoors, you better take them outdoors and show them how to do it, so that's good. The reflection follow-up support, our study that Anita and I did, every single professional development study supports that. There's no question on that. Where the question mark comes in is the details of it all. What kind of follow-up support? How much follow-up support? All that. We did not look at incentives, and so I left nothing there. Okay, so with that, I could either stop now. Yes?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know. Okay. When I first approached Michelle about what we're trying to do here, you know, I gave it a big spiel. We want to do this, identify these best practices, and all that. And the first words out of her mouth are, "Oh, Kevin." but I think what we'll do is most. So, Michelle, I do want to stop right here, because we do. I want to give people some time to work before lunch, mm-hmm. and ask you questions. Mm-hmm. So, what we're going to do, just we'll push lunch back to 12:30. Mark will probably do North Bay talk when we come back from lunch. But I do want to give some work time and then Q&A for Michelle. So, what questions do people have for her?
Michelle, you had a question mark next to the minimum of 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what would take a check mark off that? You had a question mark, I'm sorry.
How do you get a check mark? longer duration.
3 days, 4 days.
Oh my gosh, well, it depends on what the goal is. What's the goal? If the goal is, like I said, learning, you know, new information, we go to the characteristic knowledge of issues, even action, knowledge of different actions you can take, all that, I would think you can do in that time period. But if we're talking behavior change, I hate it. Can you go down and see if it... Okay. When I looked at the programs, the environmental ed programs that lead to behavior change, on average, and this is why I selected yours sort of as an exception, because frankly I was very surprised to get the results that we did, on average, 1 to 2 years.
And that's like experiences that would happen throughout that 1 to 2 years.
Yes, exactly. Now,
And it all depends. And this is why it's a little bit scary to talk about best practices to researchers, because it's always context dependent. Let me give you an example of where you can get behavior change in a very short time period. Rain barrels. You want people to install rain barrels, adults, homeowners. You bring them all to a workshop. Let's say maybe you get them to a workshop. They're already a self-selected audience because they want to do this. You bring them, it's all targeted on here's the rain barrel. Here's how you do it. Let's do one now together. Okay, now team up with a buddy, go home and help each other do it. Okay, week later. Were you able to do it? Couldn't, any trouble, I could come help. No question that this is a very short program that will lead to the behavior change of installing the rain barrels. I'm confident. It's very short. But it's designed with that behavior change in mind, very targeted, et cetera. So to say that it has to be a 1 to 2 year program to lead behavior change is not fair, because no, not necessarily. It all depends. I'm just saying, on average, across the board.
But that program is longer, because that follow-up.
Okay, I threw the follow-up in. Okay, I knew it as I was saying it. You're just like my students. Okay. Yeah, but I think that even if you didn't do the follow-up on this case, I still think you'd have.
I think if you didn't, you would still have some, but if you did the follow-up,
it would increase tremendously. Yes, and that's why, you know, professional development literature is so, the follow-up is so important.
But there's no guarantee that they're going to keep that rain barrel up.
Right.
The maintenance is another issue. Yes.
It's how you define the behavior.
It's defined, yeah, exactly. I defined it as installation.
Right.
I'm
on the same page with you.
So we're talking about outdoor experiences, though. You said, well, minimal 2 outdoor experiences. I mean, there's one thing about going on an island out in the middle of the bay and spending, you know, a few days there. There's nothing about teachers taking their students out on their schoolyard or smaller experiences nearby. I don't know what that definition really is for an outdoor experience, as long as it includes some of those characteristics that we're talking about on issues based. But is it a week of 1 hour experiences with students outdoors?
I don't think there are any answers to that question. Right. I think it always just depends. Mm-hmm. But if you're asking, you asked us here to tell you best practices, mm-hmm. and so if I'm forced to make a generalization,
you're forced.
I'm forced. Then I'd rather stick with my generalization where I feel safe, mm-hmm. than to go with one.
Did you read anything about ongoing support or support during implementation? Support of the teachers during implementation of the instruction based on the PD that they participated in?
I know lots about that. The question is, what would you like to know?
What was that included in your 2 day, 2 week, 2 year type of timeline?
I would push it, but that's in control, so I can't. It's just this.
You're saying length of time or length of support?
Well, you were talking about success in the implementation of this type of PD.
Yes.
And in that type of PD, were you also discussing support during implementation?
That's right. That's what we meant. When I say follow-up support, we were meaning support during implementation. And that was very important. Now, did we ask about what type of support in that MeWe study? No, we did not. We did not go into the details. We just couldn't. But we know a lot about that within the professional development literature that I would think would apply.
So could, for example, support of a teacher as they're trying to implement these strategies in their classroom with their students, could that then become an effective component of this type of PD?
Yes, that would be, I think, very good to do. So we know, like, mentoring, probably like an ideal situation of a mentoring, teachers mentoring each other,
So if you had a master MeWe teacher who would then be willing to support a novice MeWe teacher come into his or her classroom and illustrate. There are other ways to do it cheaper, which we have marvelous technologies available to us now. And I wish I could have gotten to see that MeWe video. And Shannon, I'm glad you and I can share and commiserate in this equipment. It's what that video would have been like. Because, for example, you could see videotaping teachers, different teachers in different contexts, implementing MeWe's, putting those online, and then having, for example, professional development, you know, around those practices, not just in an initial phase, but also on an ongoing basis, you know, because when you look at them at the video in the beginning, you're going to see certain things that are going to capture your attention. Then you've done a MeWe, and you're going to look at that same video, and you're going to see something totally different. Oh, yeah, I had that problem, too. I didn't even think I was going to have that problem. So you can do support in many different ways. It depends on what resources you have available and what your goals are, again. Does that answer some of your question? But I think that that follow-up support is in the minimum maybe there, but the question is, what is it? And that could be fleshed out, potentially. Yes?
I know we're short on time, but...
You don't really need to eat lunch. This is so much more interesting. We can live off of research.
Where do you draw the line from your perspective between stewardship and behavior change? So if you're looking for behavioral outcomes, you're talking about stewardship as something else. Where's that overlap, or where do you draw the line?
Okay, everybody has a different definition of stewardship, so I have to see what, you know, I don't have a particular definition.
What are you using?
I'm using stewardship only because Noah has used it, I believe. So if I say stewardship on there, it's because the program is using it. But I looked at, I guess I would look at stewardship as components of knowledge, attitude, skills, and behavior in my mind. Does that answer your question?
Well, I hate to refer to a slide that we can't get
we
to,
can't
but
get
there
to
is
it.
Some verbiage in there where I was struggling with how you were looking at stewardship and components of it in one section, and then in another section, you have behavioral change, behavioral outcomes, and unfold.
And that may be because of what the literature I was looking at, and the literature used certain language, so I just used that language. But when I say, like, the behavior, the environmental education programs where I look for behavior outcomes, it was behavioral outcomes specifically, not knowledge or attitude or skills or anything else.
Are you talking in your example for behavior outcome with the rain barrel, that was installing a rain barrel? To
yes.
me, stewardship is the ability to continually make decisions.
And I wanted to say, and I think this is a perfect way for us to
segue into
and move in, is that I think we're going to dig much deeper into that question in the panel after lunch to some extent when we look at some of the variables that define environmentally responsible behaviors. Or that would lead to that with Dr. Volk and Beth when they get their presentation. So I think we're going to be able to get a little bit more into that work. And then another thought as it relates to the teacher professional development discussion, which I think is also really important, and this was great to hear, is that, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of work, particularly within the State Department of Education, in identifying best practices around teacher PD, right, which are universal, right, that apply no matter what the content or the pedagogy is. Your focus on, and I think we're certainly looking to build, you know, to embrace those where it seems appropriate, but also to identify those best practices that are more unique to the pedagogies or the content that is important to environmental education. Right? And I think your points about if you want to teach outdoors, you actually have to practice teaching. Those are the kinds of things that we're looking to surface, in addition to the great body of work that's out there, probably about teacher PD, you know, best practices in general, which we certainly need to build.
So I'm not sure I answered your question, but I'm happy to talk with you afterwards.
Perfect. Thanks. So Natalie, lunch is downstairs?
It is, on the first floor.
First floor. Yep. So let's take until 12:30. That's when the bell will ring. And, that's when it'll be. Right? 12:30? What time is it now? 12:15. Sorry. 15 minutes to work our tables?
Before we go
to lunch.
Right. You're in charge.
Okay. Let's take 15 minutes to our tables because we just heard all this and I don't want to eat and come back and lose that. So let's just take 15 minutes to work our tables. Obviously, people will go
in. Working on the scorecard.
Correct. This afternoon we have Rachel and Bo talk about school-based programs, and then Julian's going to talk about
the
Okay, great.
Can I are you?
Yeah, this is not mine. Let me get you one of mine.
I don't remember seeing just the same thing.
Okay, well, let me pull it up and show me exactly how you want.
And then when I'm viewing it, you want it just as like normal slideshow like this? Okay. Let me go.
Yeah, I think he's right.
So we're saying Simmons is essential for guided by the
teacher should be training on how environmental.
I mean,
Yeah, I mean, it's not, yeah, but it's not, I mean, measurement is something that we want to measure to make sure that we are promoting the right thing, putting our resources in the right places, doing the right thing. Yes, but, yes, tracking's got to be part.
But you can,
track.
So it is time for lunch.
Can I get the standards be unit? So come back, come here by 1:15.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It is lunchtime now, so I'll be back up here by 1:15.
Ben might be coming in here to help me.
Oh, yeah.
On it.
I'm still trying to adjust what I'm going to say based on everything.
Good, that's kind of what we've adapted now.
He is in the plaid shirt, I believe. Glasses, the beard.
Gotcha. Okay. Just making sure there's one presentation on here that isn't opening, so I just wanted to make sure that I had all of them right.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically what is going to happen is Ben may or may not be up here for the working session. I got the video recorded to start recording, so I'll at least record the rest of it.
That's great.
And then I also have these little recordings for all of those people that are on just now.
I'm just going to wait for Shannon.
Okay.